to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Today is Tuesday, and that means Tinky Tank Tuesday, where we look at the Tea Party Tink Tank. That's right, the Tink Tank, otherwise known as the Commonwealth Foundation. We're going to take a look at what they're spewing this week. Also in the second hour, it's Tree Hugger Tuesday. We're going to be talking with Jan Jarrett from Penn Future about the Marcellus Shale drilling. And in the third hour, retired president of the AFL-CIO here in Pennsylvania, Billy George, will be here to fire up the base. Because I've got to tell you, I think the base needs a little Billy, a little injection of wow. But before we get to all that, the gay-obsessed party has, yes, they have successfully denied the nation's service members to serve their country openly and freely, and more importantly, to do so without reprisal. And for me, that's the key. Without reprisal. You know, I don't know that I'm thrilled with some of the satire that's out there on the far right, you know, where, you know, now the uniforms are going to be pink and all of the stereotypes that you see. I've met some gay men who would beat you senseless. It has nothing to do with any of that. It's about people being who they are and allowed to do so freely without reprisal. That's the key for me. And what we've done in this country is we've thrown 15,000 or 13,000 people, they're estimating, out of the military since 1993. Since this whole ridiculous don't ask, don't tell. We've thrown 13,000 fighting people out of our service. And to me, it's just plain wrong. I don't care what people do within the confines of their four walls, as long as you don't bring it into the workplace. As long as it's not one of those things, Jake, that's going to hamper you from doing your job. And we're going to take your calls on this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. That's the number if you've got a thought. Look, you know, Secretary of Defense Gates, Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Mullen, he's saying, look, you know, we think it's time to repeal this. They want it to be slowly, and they want it to be done over, you know, over a period to kind of ease it in, which I understand. But the Republicans, the gay-obsessed party, absolutely no way, no how. Not one Republican voted for closure, not one.
And isn't it amazing? This is the party that says we need to listen to the troops. We need to listen to the people who are doing the fighting. And if you listen to the leaders, they're saying, look, it's time. And I can tell you, Rick, I was listening to the radio today, and it was the hot subject locally. And this is a conservative area. And there must have been four or five calls of ex-military people, and they all said, look, I served with gay people. I knew it. But I also knew that when we went out, and some of them did see combat, they said when we went out, they covered our back, and that's all I care about.
And that's all you should care about. And as I've said 1,000 times, what you do with other consenting adults in the confines of your four walls without, you know, not in my face, but what you do in your home is your business. Has nothing to do with me. And what bothers me is not one Republican stepped forward and said, you know what, we're going to honor people's constitutional right for the government not to persecute them. That's what this is really about. This is about the government saying, well, you know, we're going to punish you for this. We're going to throw you out of the military. And I can't not say that you had a Democrat who voted against it as well. And had we gotten rid of her, I would be much happier. And I got to be honest, when she loses here in November, Blanche Lincoln, I will be very happy because then, you know, what's the difference if we lose her to a Republican? Nothing. Because she doesn't give us any votes anyway. So another, you know, here we go. More obstructionism, more conservative Democrats siding on the side of the Republicans.
Well, and the two women that were considering, two Republican women that earlier had been in support and then came back, and I think it was purely political cover, said, well, we didn't like the way Harry Reid handled it. I think it was more the leadership said, look, we have to fire up our base. We can't vote yay on this. We have to vote no to get our people out this fall.
Well, here's the reality. Look, and that's exactly what this is. It's purely politics. They could not, the Republicans could not allow the Democrats to have anything that looked like a victory, anything that looked like they were actually moving forward on their campaign pledges, moving forward on their promises. So what they're hoping is that they've demoralized the base of the Democratic Party, which is, you know, been several of these advocacy groups, be it labor, be it rights, civil rights, be it, you know, gay rights. What you've done is you've demoralized those bases. And they're hoping that they'll stay home. Or worse yet, they're hoping that they'll punish the Democrats by voting against them. I don't know that that's going to work. Because, I hope people are smarter than this. This is pure politic on the part of the Republicans. And it's frustrating. And it is, but this is part of how the game is played. And they want frustrated voters. And I look at the primaries, Jake, and I'm begging people, you got to get out and vote in November. Because, you know, a handful of angry people are what turned that election in Delaware. Just a handful. And, look, I've had acquaintances who are gay. And they're decent people. They're the kind of people I would want to have as neighbors. And there's this... Without getting too personal about some of the people that I've known over the years, I honestly know that this is not a choice. This is who these people are, and they were always meant to be that way. And that even sounds like there's something wrong with it. The way I put that, even. I mean, this is one of those issues that it's hard to articulate without putting myself in the middle of it. I mean, it's very difficult.
And isn't it amazing? Isn't it amazing? I thought the last two election cycles, this issue and the gun issue went away. It's one of those issues that can easily divide people, and here we are again.
But for me, I really don't care what consenting adults do within their confines of their home. Now, if you're talking about children, if you're talking about any number of things that we've already deemed illegal, I'm with you on that. But this, no. I mean, there are some states. I mean, you look at Montana who, you know, they want it to be illegal. And I don't agree with that. But again, you know, what frustrates me is you've got people on the right who are saying, well, you know, we want our liberty. We want freedom. We want the government out of our lives. But evidently not out of our bedrooms. And I worry that this now is going to be another... at least another two, possibly 4 or 6 years before this comes up again. Because right now this is a dead issue, I think. I don't think the Democrats are going to touch it again until after the election, and then it's dead in the water.
Well, they had talked about, I was watching cable tonight, and they had talked about, you know, the lame duck session already. There's one or two key Democrats that said, no way, ethically I don't agree in lame duck legislation. So it's dead for the most part.
And along with it goes the DREAM Act, because that was also part of this bill that hasn't gotten as much press as this, because you don't have an awful lot of people out there who are as strongly advocating as you have on this. But again, you know, the DREAM Act is now dead, because that was also a portion of this. So by, you know, the John McCain's of the world filibustering this, this is what we end up with. Nothing forward. And I guess there's some blame that you could possibly put on Harry Reid for not allowing amendments. But let me ask you, what amendment would you put on somebody's civil right, on the right to do whatever it is they want to do within their home? And this is where the libertarian streak in me comes out. I don't want our government involved in our lives inside the confines of my home. I should be able to do whatever it is I want to do. And I know I'm going to get somebody say, well, should you be allowed to shoot heroin? Part of me says yes. Although I'm not going to fight for the legalization of people shooting up heroin. But in the confines of your home, I do believe people should be able to act however they want. And I don't want our government coming and saying, we're going to make this illegal, or we're going to throw you out of the military. I imagine that. I mean, these people love their country. They want to serve their country. They're willing to fight, bleed, and die for their country. But they cannot, if found out, be who they are. And, you know, I read something not too long ago that the guys are actually being raped more often than the women are in our military, because they know that this guy can't go run and tell the captain that, you know, this happened, because of don't ask, don't tell. Is that the kind of thing that we want? I don't think so. And, you know, again, this is one of those things that opens people up to blackmail, opens people up to problems. Is that what we want for our military? Although I did have a friend of mine, well, do you want a bunch of fancy pants running around with pink dresses on? You want a bunch of clingers? Remember Clinger from MASH, who mm-hmm. always acted like he was...
That's a real stereotype, and it's not typical of a gay person, either in the military or in civilian life.
And I said, look, at the end of it, man, you know, if he's not doing his job, he's going to get booted out because he's not doing his job, and I'm in favor of that. It's frustrating. It's just, you know, it amazes me. The very people who are out there fighting, I want my rights, are the ones who are most willing to deny other people of theirs. The very people who say, well, what we need to do is we need to cut those people off unemployment or cut them off of welfare programs. But they're the first to say when it's their turn to collect, well, this isn't enough. We need more. Interesting times we live in, Jake. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back right after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A solid majority of voters in election battleground states want to extend tax cuts for the middle class while ending them for people with incomes of more than $250,000 a year. The Greenberg Quinlan Rosner research firm conducted the poll in 7 battleground states for the Service Employees International Union. The poll was conducted in California, Colorado, Illinois, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Washington, and Wisconsin. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says the poll shows that Americans of all stripes agree that working families and small business, not the wealthy, need and deserve tax cuts. The International Association of Machinists is looking at October 14th as a start date for a vote at Delta that could see 14,000 baggage handlers unionized. Jesse Russell reports.
The National Mediation Board announced the election date on Tuesday and said it will run until November 18th. The vote will include workers who are already unionized but came on board when Delta and Northwest merged in 2008. An additional date is expected to be announced for gate workers at Delta. They would also be represented by the IAM if the vote results in the affirmative. Flight attendants will start voting for or against union representation on September 29th, with the results expected on November 3rd. According to numbers released by the U.S. Department of Transportation's Bureau of Transportation Statistics on Tuesday, Delta now has the most full-time employees of any airline, increasing its staff in July by 5.7%. That increase is mostly due to the merger with Northwest.
The International Longshore and Warehouse Union is out with a report on Rite Aid drugstores criticizing what the union says is mismanagement under new owners. The report, Navigating Rough Waters, Can New Management Steer Rite Aid Back on Course, is being distributed to stock analysts, financial advisors, and industry trade reporters as Rite Aid prepares to issue its quarterly financial report. The union says Rite Aid management is trying to solve its financial problems on the backs of its workers. Workers at Rite Aid warehouse operations are struggling for union recognition, basic rights, and a voice at work. Workers at a Lancaster, California Rite Aid warehouse began a union organizing effort in 2006. They won an NLRB election in 2008 and have been negotiating with management for a first contract ever since. The union says instead of bargaining in good faith to agree on a contract, Rite Aid management has been engaged instead in a needless conflict with its workers. An increase in the Consumer Price Index will see a slight raise for Oregon's minimum wage come January. The state's minimum wage will bump up from $8.40 per hour to $8.50 an hour, thanks to that state's minimum wage being tied to the index. The index rose by 1% last month. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We keep South Central Pennsylvania wired. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, right here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And for 93 years, we have proudly provided our contractors and their customers with the highest skilled and best educated electricians in the industry. Whether it's wiring a light socket in a Habitat for Humanity's home or replacing a vital component on a nuclear reactor, our professional electricians do the job right the first time. Our members are the backbone of our community and our nation, working to make tomorrow a brighter day. If you want to join us, or if you need an electrician for your industrial or commercial project, call us at 717-232-7093 or visit our website at www.ibewlocal143.org. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, and we keep South Central Pennsylvania wired.
Always by your side.
The surge is on in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, the surge that appears to be most effective is not the 30,000 additional U.S. troops that President Obama has now poured into this hellacious war, but a wholly unexpected surge by the enemy. General David Petraeus' surge strategy was to concentrate our soldiers in the Afghan south and east, attacking the Taliban where they are strongest. The gleaming gemstone of this plan was to be the taking of Kandahar, Afghanistan's second-largest city and the birthplace of the Taliban. This goal was supposed to have been achieved months ago, but, well, stuff happens. Or in this case, doesn't happen. The assault on Kandahar is finally underway, but meanwhile the Taliban has slipped away and is surging throughout the country, including in provinces that were previously Taliban-free. Indeed, 4 years ago, the enemy had strongholds in only four of Afghanistan's 34 provinces. Now, they're in 33 of them, and practically every independent observer of the war says that Afghanistan has become more dangerous than at any time since our 2001 invasion. It's so dangerous that election officials simply shut down hundreds of polling places in 25 provinces for September's parliamentary elections. And international observers could not even go into the rural areas where most Afghans live. This gave a free hand to warlords and political power brokers to commit a massive level of voting fraud that delegitimizes the national election. Even America's hawkish foreign policy establishment has begun arguing that this war is neither winnable nor worth the enormous costs we're paying in lives, money, and reputation. As one establishmentarian now flatly says, a U.S. military victory over the Taliban is simply not necessary to protect U.S. interests. This is Jim Hightower saying, bingo!
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Official supporter of Palin Santorum 2012. The Rick Smith Show.
This is what we need. More insane Republicans. Get ready, folks. The floodgates are about to open and the victims are getting their pitchforks. You may remember the last couple of days I talked about the sexting DA, the guy in Wisconsin who was prosecuting this. He's prosecuting this guy for domestic violence. I'm not sure. It didn't say what the guy was on trial, what he had done to end up in court. But the district attorney who was prosecuting him was, at the time, sending racy text messages to his girlfriend. And some of them were pretty, well, I can't recite them on the air, at least not on the terrestrial waves. But this appears that it's not the first time this guy has done this. And if you read some of these texts, you go, this is pretty bold stuff. You had to know this isn't his first time. And the AP reports that this woman named Maria Roskowitz told them that on Tuesday she met Calumet County District Attorney Ken Kratz in his office in 2008 to discuss a decade-old drug conviction. She was looking to have it, pardon. She was looking to get it cleaned off of her record because, you know, she wants to move on with her life. She made a mistake as a young woman and, you know, trying to get that off her record. And afterwards, she said that Kratz sent her a bunch of text messages too. And soon they turned harassing, including one on how she would please him, how shall we say, in the happy room. So much so that this woman went to her professor, her law professor, and said, hey, what can we do about this guy? And I'm telling you, we're going to see more of this stuff. Of course, Kratz's lawyer says he doesn't know anything about the case, but, you know, he says, you know, as a good Republican would, I'm going to seek reelection. And I'm going to go back after him and seek reelection. The internet's not plugged in. Oh boy. Well, if you want to hear something else that's going to make you laugh. I'm sorry, inside joke, folks. Again, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. A new Fox News poll has been out. It says that Christine O'Donnell is trailing Chris Coons by 15%. In Delaware, the Tea Party is lukewarm, evidently. This new poll, of course, conducted on September 18th, was released Tuesday, showing Democratic Senate nominee Christine Coons leading O'Donnell by 15 points, 54 to 39. 60% of those surveyed said O'Donnell is not qualified to be a U.S. senator. What scares me about that is there are 40% of the people who evidently must think she is qualified, which scares me to no end. Also in the poll, likely voters would have backed Mike Castle, the moderate Republican who lost to O'Donnell over Coon by double-digit margin, 48 to 35. But after the poll's other questions also revealed that the Tea Party is something that people don't know much about. And it's basically what we've been saying. You know, they were a handful of very motivated people who got out and went to the polls. And as I pointed out, you know, the night it happened, you're looking at a state with 621,000 voters, 30,000 came out to the polls to vote for her. That's it. Of that is not a majority. It also goes on to say more than 1,000 likely voters surveyed, 46% disapprove of the job the president is doing, and 45% approve. But that's not translating into support for the Tea Party. 40% surveyed strongly oppose the Tea Party. 40% strongly oppose the Tea Party. 21% strongly support it. Interesting numbers.
Well, there's some... I guess you could call it developments. We have heard rumors, and I think it's more than a rumor, about the feds coming in and investigating her. There was a lady on MSNBC on Ed's show tonight, Rick. A woman by the name of Melanie Sloan, she's a spokesman for the watchdog group that we had talked about earlier. And, you know, she's saying that she has affidavits from two of Mrs. O'Donnell's campaign who swear and have signed affidavits that she took money from her campaign, not only in 2009, and that's key, so she did before 2009 and 2010. And she did 2010. And she didn't, and this isn't very smart, she didn't pay them from time to time. So, you know, if you want these people to be loyal to you, I think you ought to pay them. But she's in serious trouble. She's in serious trouble.
She is in trouble. And the woman that you spoke of, Melanie Sloan, who was on this program last week, you know, she said the same thing. Look, we want her investigated. And I asked her flat out. I said, is there any way that she can justify using campaign dollars to pay for her house and to pay for her living expenses? And the answer was flat out no. And yet there are numerous reports out there and there are numerous checks out there of her doing just that. So look, as I said on our weekend program, to me, O'Donnell is the kamikaze that's sinking the Tea Party because she has awakened the sleeping majority. People are looking at this woman and saying, oh, my God, she's crazy. Oh, my goodness, the fringe has taken over. And, you know, last night we had a caller who said, you know, he thought the Tea Party was 40% of the electorate. And I don't know where he lives, but I'm looking at this going, no, they're the fringe that's always been there. They just now have this organizing money that's coming from big moneyed interests like the Koch brothers or the Cook brothers or whatever you want to call them. And these front groups that are just funneling millions and millions of dollars to keep these people riled up and enraged. And so they're not paying attention. But I think the sleeping majority is waking up to the fact that we could have a woman in the U.S. Senate who is just plain off her rocker. I mean, you know, from what I've read, she's never held a job, really. She's never been a tax-paying citizen. Somehow she's made an existence of who knows. And like I've said in the past, I mean, you've got these people who are gold diggers. Somehow they figure out how to, you know, the Cato Kalins of the world who figure out how to keep things moving. And now we've got the Christine O'Donnells of the world who somehow for a year she earned $5,800 somewhere doing what? I don't know. But somehow she made $5,800 and she gave herself more than $3,000 back in her campaign. I don't know how you make a living on $2,700 in a year.
Who does she remind you of? Now think about it.
She reminds me of Palin,
that's
another
exactly
gold digger.
Exactly right.
Another gold digger.
She's attractive. She dresses well. She actually speaks well. No, that doesn't mean that she speaks the truth. She speaks well. And what is her shtick? Her shtick is, well, I'm being attacked by my political enemies. She sounds almost verbatim like Sarah Palin, looks a lot like her.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I've said this for years. Women should run this country. Because men see a good-looking woman and the blood all leaves their brain and they get stupid. I think that's God's cruel little joke on us. That, you know, somehow, you know, I forget what the old saying was, the bigger the chest, the smaller the male IQ standing in front of them. And I think it's true. I think to a degree you look at them and guys' brains just go haywire.
Well, plus, I mean, let's not let the Tea Party off here, Rick. I mean, the people in that party tend to just, they're devout, and they believe in their cause so much, it almost doesn't matter what the other side says about their candidates. They are so dedicated to the cause that they're tone deaf.
I think you can say that about any person who's fanatical about what it is that they believe on any issue, on any side of the coin. If you are a devout follower of anything, if you're one of these blind faith followers, no amount of rational thought, no amount of reasoning, no amount of discussion, no facts, no anything is going to change you from your position. And as I've always said, we should let them go. They've always been among us. They've always been walking around next to us. Just let them go. See, in the past, they were the guys, you know, walking around with the signs. The sky's falling. You know, the guys on the street corner with the sandwich boards. Let them go. You know, just, they've always been there. Ignore them. The difference now is, you know, now they've got a whole lot of money. And they're getting an awful lot of media attention. And the corporate special interests and the big moneyed interests in this country use them as the useful idiot doofus base who they can, you know, puppet around on a string to get the rest of us divided. Look, this election is about health care. This election is about jobs. This election is about middle class families. That's what this election cycle is about. It's not about some guy where he's a Muslim, Kenyan, socialist, communist, fascist, you know, isms. It's not about that. It's about how do we create the best America we can create? And do we want to go back to the policies that got us into some really, really bad positions? Do we want to go back to the Bush years? Do we? I don't think so. And our friend Bill Scheer over at the Campaign for America's Future has a piece that I just thought I had to go through. And he's picked out 10 of the craziest things conservatives have said about the economy recently. And Bill did a good job. And I think I've gone through all of these at one point or another, but it's a nice to see them all together. You've got Joe Miller, the guy who's running for Senate out in Alaska, the Tea Party guy. He said, quote, the unemployment compensation benefits have gotten, first of all, it's not constitutionally authorized. This guy's a lawyer and doesn't even realize that. But then again, here's the thing. I think he's a very strict, you know, one of these strict guys. If it's not specifically in there, if it's not expressly in there, if it's not written in there, every sentence, every paragraph, it's not there. And that's not at all what the amendment says. It's not at all. There's no express, things are expressly written to the federal government. No, it doesn't say that. Number nine, one of my favorites, South Carolina Lieutenant Governor Andrew Bauer, criticizing assistance to the poor, said, quote, my grandmother was not a highly educated, well, hold on, I got to do it in a South Carolina accent. My grandmother was not a highly educated woman. And she told me as a small child to quit feeding the strays. You know why? Because they breed. So think about that for a second. We don't want to feed poor people because they'll breed, but we don't want to have them have abortions either. Todd Akin said we could have gone back to the days of FDR, who also had a recession that he turned into a Great Depression because he used a wrong economic theory. Think about that for a second. Ooh. Think about the rewriting of history that went into that sentence. Because Roosevelt wasn't elected until 32. The Depression started at the end of 29 into 30. I'm guessing, and hey, maybe he's got a rewritten book that I haven't seen yet, but that's not historically accurate.
He's not the first Republican to try to rewrite history. To this day, they claim FDR actually, you know, he wasn't
the Depression.
He that's right. He was the cause of it, and he actually didn't get us out of it. There's some truth to that in the sense that totally the Great Depression ended the start of the second World War. However, he brought this country a long way from 32 to 1941.
Number seven, Dean Heller, the representative, says, is the government now creating hobos? Not quite sure what he meant by that, but it's a dumb statement nonetheless. Number six, I believe, says Paul Brown, that estate taxes should be zero. I believe that corporate taxes should be zero. And that dividend taxes should be zero. Well, then who's going to pay for all the rich people's things? Who's going to pay for the courts? And who's going to pay for the roads and the bridges and the education system? Who's going to pay for all those things that the wealthy benefit from? I wonder who he thinks. Number five, Scott Brown commented on something that was actually deemed pants on fire by the fact-check site PolitiFact. He said, quote, the last stimulus bill didn't create one job. And this is one of those things that the Obama administration has not done enough of. They haven't gotten out there and said, these are the jobs we've created. This is what has been done from the stimulus. And one of the things I like is we talked to Paul Bachman one day, and he was saying, look, here's where the money's going. Look at this project and this project. And right down the line, you could see projects that had begun and were in the middle and being done, and people were working from them. You need to see that. You absolutely need to see that this money is being used in the way that it was meant to be used.
And the truth is, some of the stimulus was used to prevent layoffs. Now, did it create a job? No, but it prevented jobs from being discontinued. And in vital services, we're talking police, talking firemen, we're talking teachers. We're talking some extremely important jobs in society.
And then the denial quote from Mitch McConnell, senator from Kentucky, he said, quote, there's no evidence whatsoever that the Bush tax cuts actually diminished revenue. They increased revenue. So let me think about this for a second. If I could. We gave $1.7 trillion away. And of that $1.7 trillion, they're saying 80% of it went to the very top of the economic scale, of which they invested that money in places like China, places like Asia, places overseas, took jobs out of this country. Kind of makes you wonder. Number three, Senator John Kyle of Arizona, quote, continuing to pay people unemployment compensation is a disincentive for them to seek new work. Hey, ding dong, there are no jobs out there. There are five people seeking every one job available. Five for every one job. You know, if there were jobs out there, and this is what people don't understand about unemployment. If your employer were to call you back to work, you would no longer be collecting unemployment.
That's correct.
And if you refused to go back, they called you back and they said, you know, come back, and you said, no, I'm going to sit here on unemployment, you would no longer collect unemployment. And that's, you know, that's the fallacy, that's the thing that they're playing on, that people think, well, you know, once you're on it until you decide you want to get off. No. Your employer calls you back, you go back, or you're gone. That simple. Number two comes from our Tea Party quack out in Nevada. Sharon Angle said, we have spoiled our citizenry and said, you don't want the job that are available? Don't worry about it. Again, going back to this theory that the unemployed want to be unemployed. Look, I've got friends who, you know, they had $1,000 a week jobs, $1,200 a week jobs. They're collecting $564 a week with no health insurance, with no pension benefits, with none of that. And they're paying tax on that $564 a week, thanks to our friend Ronald Reagan. One of the biggest slaps in the face to working people that I can recall. And that's what it was.
The reason these comments, these stupid comments about extending unemployment benefits is unconstitutional and people are lazy and they just don't want to take the open jobs. The difference is, yes, there were other downturns. And there were other downturns when people were laid off for six months, a year, in the last couple decades. The problem with this downturn is that many of these jobs are now gone. And that's why you have over 40% of those on unemployment who are on unemployment over a year because their jobs simply aren't there. There's no jobs to go back to.
Yep, they're gone.
That's the difference.
Yep. And the number one comes from House Minority Leader John Boehner, Mr. Tan Man. He said, quote, well, I don't need to see GDP numbers or listen to economists. Yeah, don't, I don't want facts, and I don't want to talk to people who actually know what they're talking about. I want to stick to my boneheaded beliefs. Let's go to the phones. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We got Spike on line one. How are we doing today, Spike?
Oh, doing all right. I'm one of those quote-unquote moochers the right wing's talking about with unemployment, and, you know, they used to be a time where once I left another job, I quickly found another. Those days are long gone.
Yep.
And, you know, the funny thing with the unemployment numbers, which, by the way, you know, I get a very, very small amount even from unemployment at this point. I'm only collecting about probably $125 a week.
Wow.
And now I'm going to be losing, I've just finally ran out of the federal, you know, after taxes, $44 for 2 weeks. Trust me, I'd much rather have a job where I'd not only be able to pay my bills comfortably, but I could even do something with money, like, go to a game, go out for the night, have a life. This is not by choice at all. Yeah, then again, the same people who are saying we're doing this by choice are the ones who say being gay is by choice. So they have this convoluted mindset that because everything is the individual choice. These are all people who would be F students in sociology with their ability to see things as far as they can reach their hand in front of their face.
Spike, most of them were F students. Which is why you get people like Christine O'Donnell, who is now a senatorial candidate.
Yeah. Well, we have a Christine O'Donnell up here in Pat Toomey, that's for sure.
No. Pat Toomey's much scarier than Christine O'Donnell. Toomey, people, there are people in this state who've actually got him ahead of Joe Sestak, and they've actually been able to paint Joe Sestak as too liberal. An admiral, too liberal.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest problem with Poland is when it's a close race, there's no known margin of error of people who no longer use traditional landlines. So the Poland process, I think, is very flawed. And anyone who uses online Poland is even more flawed because who knows who's spamming them. But I have a feeling just from being a committee man in the Democratic Party here in Monroe County, Sestak's the one guy who, at least in this area, looks very strong. I don't know about other parts of Pennsylvania, but around here there's a great deal of support. Even people who we've encountered people who were Republicans and changed party affiliation because of Joe Sestak. So, and we even got people like that with Arnold Spector as well. So I don't know how accurate a lot of these numbers and questions are. I can guarantee you if the polls were out there asking if Arnold Spector is the Republican instead of Toomey, I guarantee you Sestak would have had more work. But it's been made easier when you have someone who's just kind of a mudslinger. And the closer you get to the election, the dirtier the Toomey campaign is going to get. And I guarantee you a lot of people are going to be very turned off by Pat Toomey. And, of course, negative campaigners always hope that means you stay home. But in the same with this get rid of the slime mentality and the fact there is no incumbent at this point for this seat, I think he's going to shoot himself in the foot. And really, Joe Sestak has a lot of name recognition thanks to all that negative campaigning that Toomey's been paying for.
Yeah, good point. And I'm hoping you're right. I'm hoping that, really, I'm saying that Christine O'Donnell has really been the kamikaze pilot that's going to take down the Tea Party, because I think she's awakened the sleeping majority. I think most people woke up on Wednesday and looked at the paper and said, this woman is actually a step away from being a United States senator? Maybe I better read the article instead of the headline.
Well, the whole reason I voted for the Obama campaign wasn't because I loved Obama and Biden, especially Biden, who hasn't seen a big business he didn't like. It was because when Sarah Palin came on board and I saw the crackpots that were coming out for her, like in Johnstown and stuff, with the little curious George monkey, it was supposed to be Obama, and another guy who said to, I think it was Michael Morrill, when he was videotaping some of these people, well, I'm not a racist, but I'll never vote for a black man for president, which is the most contradictory, stupid statement one can make.
Well, No, I disagree. That is an average, everyday statement at a Tea Party. That logic is running through the Tea Party.
Yeah, well, that's true as well. But, I didn't want to see Palin getting a promotion and enabling these psychotics. So I think it'll probably once again happen in Delaware with, that one, and hopefully up here with Toomey. They'll see he's quite loony. And I really hope that'll happen. I also hope, as really, he's not a very great choice for a progressive, but I really hope if we have to choose between two guys who are supportive of Wall Street, we get in our congressional district here, Ken Jaworski, and not the king of xenophobia, Lou Barletta.
Yeah.
Who, there's a lot of question to a lot of what he's done with the immigration baloney and the court cases
and all the money, that all the taxpayer money that he's wasted.
What's that?
And all the taxpayer money he's wasted up there in Hazleton, an area that's economically depressed and could probably have used that tax money that he just basically pissed away. They could have probably used that to help the people in his community, but no, he had to score political points, and he had to get his name out there.
Exactly. You know, in most of the country, the news of distraction is bedbugs. In Hazleton, it's immigrants. Exactly. It's like in The Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Yep.
You know, instead, pay attention to the boogeyman I present for you.
And here's the shiny thing. Over here, stupid. And unfortunately, we're like you know, just a regular dog, and we pay attention to the treat on the string.
Yeah, it's pretty sad for a country that once was one of the most well-educated countries on the earth. We now seem to be intellectually behind third-world nations, which is very
scary stuff.
Shameful.
Spike, scary stuff. I appreciate the call, buddy. I got to move along, take a break right here. Call back anytime. Thanks so much.
All right, man. Have a good one.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right here. We're right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
In 1927, 800 miners in the captive company town of Rossiter, located in Pennsylvania's Indiana County, joined a nationwide bituminous coal miner strike. From the start, Judge Jonathan Langham began issuing the most drastic injunctions imaginable against the workers and their union, the United Mine Workers of America. These injunctions prohibited miners from taking part in any picketing, marching, assembly for meetings and rallies, posting of signs, or giving any type of aid or comfort to the striking miners or their families. The miners were even prohibited from putting ads in the newspaper. The most outrageous of Langham injunctions received national attention. Judge Jonathan Langham ruled that workers were prohibited from holding prayer services and singing of hymns, described as hostile songs, at the Magyar Presbyterian Church, which was the only property in town not owned by the Clearfield Bituminous Coal Corporation. Striking miners were evicted from their company-owned homes and forced to live in tent colonies. Conditions were so poor that nearly one out of every 10 babies died at birth. Reports of these deplorable conditions were the basis of a U.S. Senate investigation into the conditions of the coal fields in company towns in Pennsylvania. The investigations were led by New York Senator Robert Wagner, who later sponsored the bill creating the National Labor Relations Act, otherwise known as the Wagner Act of 1935. Senator Wagner said of the conditions he found, quote, "Had I not seen it myself, I would not have believed that in the United States there were large areas where civil government was supplanted by a system that can only be compared with ancient feudalism. The sacrifices by these workers and fights for democracy by the Rossiter citizens helped change the social and political attitudes for the century to follow. It was these deadly fights and grave sacrifices by those who came before that allow us to live so well today." The tombstone of one such worker reads, "40 years I worked with pick and drill down in the mines against my will. The coal king's slave, but now it's past. Thanks be to God, I am free at last." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons. classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Oh, well, it's Tinky Tank Tuesday. That's right. Get your Tinky Tanks out. The Commonwealth Foundation, the Tea Party think tank. You remember the Tea Party? You remember them. They're the ones who thought they had a great idea. We're going to have a truck shoot. And then, you know, the guy figured out what a truck shoot actually meant. That someone was going to take a gun and shoot his truck, and he kind of backed out of it. Whoa. I need my truck. So then they found somebody else who's okay. Oh, you can have my car. So they went from a truck shoot to a car shoot. And then the people, the adults in the room, the people who own the place probably said, you're going to do what? You're going to shoot a car with a bunch of drunken people standing around? Haven't you guys ever heard of a ricochet? So they canceled it. So the tinky tank of the Tea Party people decided that it was probably best not to have their little truck shoot.
Yeah.
Anyway, some of the things that they're spewing, I thought it would be interesting to highlight some of their writings from their website. So from their blog come two stories that kind of make you think a little bit. One is written, it says, Pennsylvania has been collecting info on citizens for years. There has been a hullabaloo, he says, over the discovery that Pennsylvania's Office of Homeland Security, under the Emergency Management Agency, has been paying a private company to put together details about protests and rallies that may or may not turn violent. These event lists were then sent out via bulletin to local police and potential targets. While it is a waste of taxpayer money to pay a consultant to troll Google for event listings, the outrage is a bit late. The Pennsylvania Department of State has for years been collecting information about the political activity of average citizens. Worse yet, they post this information online for all to see, including the city and the employer of each individual. They say it's called campaign finance disclosure. So that's an interesting little statement. Here's the thing. Here's the problem I have with it. So we're against transparency? Is that what they're trying to tell me? They're against me knowing who's funding Pat Toomey? They're against me knowing who's buying our politicians? Again, remember, you gotta know who's funding the tinky-tinky-tinky-tank. People who don't want you to know they're funding the tinky-tinky-tinky-tank. And they don't want you to know how much they're spending. They want to lurk in the shadows. They want to be able to spend as much money influencing our politicians as possible.
I was listening to him, the spokesman for Commonwealth Foundation, Matt Briette. And from time to time, he's the guest narrator of the local talk show in Harrisburg when the
Tinky Head.
Right. When the normal man, whose show it is, isn't there. And a couple of weeks ago, he was there all week. And there was a caller who came in and started questioning him about where his organization, the Commonwealth Foundation, gets their money. And you know what his answer was? Well, they come from just average citizens.
Well, then
just average citizens. Well, just common folk. Well, they come from individuals. He is right about that. But common folk, I don't think so.
But here's the thing. And I'm all in favor of whoever wants to give the Tinky Tank money. And you have the right to do that. And it's none of my business. Because the Tinky Tank doesn't make laws. When you start giving money to politicians,
when you start attempting to influence the process. I want to know who. I want to know how much. So this way we can go back and we can find which politicians are lining their pockets and helping the who. It's that simple. It's called transparency. So our friends at the Tinky Tank, anti-transparency. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. And the other piece from the Tinky Tank, the Post-Gazette, they write, reports the highest bid for a lease of Pittsburgh's parking garages came in at $452 million, well above what was expected. While the city of Pittsburgh needs to do far more to resolve its financial crisis, such as, you know, they're going to beat the drum on the pension system for public employees, which they were in favor of not funding, and they've been trying to destroy for years, but that's a whole other rant. They write, privatizing parking is a good step in the right direction. Yeah, we might as well sell off all the city assets. Sell all those off. You know, all those things that brought money into the city. Get rid of all that stuff. They write, Pittsburgh's experience could serve as a lesson to other cities, including Harrisburg, which sits on the verge of bankruptcy. Got to get that in there. Indeed, while Pennsylvania cities have established special district governments like the Harrisburg Parking Authority or the Philadelphia Parking Authority to operate parking facilities, it is rare in the rest of the nation. In fact, 95.9% of special district governor revenues from parking facilities in the U.S. are from Pennsylvania. Well, you just said they were rare. And they love to throw that 95.9% number out there because we're smart in this state. Parking is a revenue-generating business. That revenue we use to help fund things that we need to pay for. If you're coming down to a ball game, I would rather have that money that I'm paying for parking go to the city coffers to pay for programs that the city needs as opposed to taxing me. Instead, what we have is we have a privatized parking system. I know where I lived in Cleveland, one of the things that they started doing is they're privatizing the garages. And where does all that money go that we pay? Well, that money goes into the hands of private for-profit interests. So, you know, what amazed me is that in Pittsburgh, they're talking about $452 million that somebody offered to lease the parking garages in Pittsburgh. $452 million? Think about this for a second. That means this private for-profit interest sees $452 million in revenue coming in plus profit, lots and lots of profit. Why else would they offer that much money, Jake?
You hit it.
But you got the people at the Tinky Tank. All they want you to hear is, privatization is good. Privatization is good. Government's bad. Yet no one, not one person has come to me and shown me an instance of where privatization has worked out for we the people. Privatization has done a great job, a marvelous job, an amazing job for the very wealthy. It's done really well for the stockholders. And here's my problem with it. They're talking about, well, we're going to lease the parking garages and we're going to lease the turnpikes and we're going to have these long-term leases where these private companies are going to get all their money out of it plus a whole bunch of profit to pay their shareholders because that's what businesses do. And what's going to happen at the end of the lease? What do we get back? Well, of course, we're going to get back parking garages that are falling down, roads that are riddled with problems, and who's going to have to pay for the repairs? We, the taxpayer. So for a short-term fix, a short-term injection of cash, we're going to, over the long term, open ourselves up to massive, massive debt. So don't let them suck you into this. Privatization has never worked. It's not going to work now. It hasn't worked in the past. Because if we can't do it and have that money fund our programs, what makes you think we're going to be able to take a for-profit interest and have them provide the service and it not be more costly? We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Jan Jarrett from Penn Future. Stick around. We'll be right back.
it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A solid majority of voters in election battleground states want to extend tax cuts for the middle class while ending them for people with incomes of more than $250,000 a year. The Greenberg Quinlan Rosner research firm conducted the poll in seven battleground states for the Service Employees International Union. The poll was conducted in California, Colorado, Illinois, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Washington, and Wisconsin. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says the poll shows that Americans of all stripes agree that working families and small business, not the wealthy, need and deserve tax cuts. The International Association of Machinists is looking at October 14th as a start date for a vote at Delta that could see 14,000 baggage handlers unionized. Jesse Russell reports.
The National Mediation Board announced the election date on Tuesday and said it will run until November 18th. The vote will include workers who are already unionized but came on board when Delta and Northwest merged in 2008. An additional date is expected to be announced for gate workers at Delta. They would also be represented by the IAM if the vote results in the affirmative. Flight attendants will start voting for or against union representation on September 29th, with the results expected on November 3rd. According to numbers released by the U.S. Department of Transportation's Bureau of Transportation Statistics on Tuesday, Delta now has the most full-time employees of any airline, increasing its staff in July by 5.7%. That increase is mostly due to the merger with Northwest.
The International Longshore and Warehouse Union is out with a report on Rite Aid drugstores criticizing what the union says is mismanagement under new owners. The report, Navigating Rough Waters, Can New Management Steer Rite Aid Back on Course?, is being distributed to stock analysts, financial advisors, and industry trade reporters as Rite Aid prepares to issue its quarterly financial report. The union says Rite Aid management is trying to solve its financial problems on the backs of its workers. Workers at Rite Aid warehouse operations are struggling for union recognition, basic rights, and a voice at work. Workers at a Lancaster, California Rite Aid warehouse began a union organizing effort in 2006. They won an NLRB election in 2008 and have been negotiating with management for a first contract ever since. The union says instead of bargaining in good faith to agree on a contract, Rite Aid management has been engaged instead in a needless conflict with its workers. An increase in the Consumer Price Index will see a slight raise for Oregon's minimum wage come January. The state's minimum wage will bump up from $8.40 per hour to $8.50 an hour, thanks to that state's minimum wage being tied to the index. The index rose by 1% last month. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. It's Tree Hugger Tuesday, and I find most of my environmental friends don't get offended when you say it's Tree Hugger Tuesday, or call them tree huggers. In fact, most people I know, they quite embrace that and find it quite comical, because they do believe in something, and they're willing to stand up and fight for something, and the environment is worth fighting for. The one issue here in the state of Pennsylvania for environmentalists right now, I think universally across the board, is what are we going to do to restrain and to control what happens when they start pumping frack water into the ground and destroying our environment, pulling the natural gas out of the Marcellus Shale find. I've got Jan Jarrett on the line. She's the president of Penn Future. PennFuture.org is the website to talk to us a little bit. Jan, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Rick. I always enjoy talking to you.
We love having you. Let me ask you, since I ask all of my environmental friends, do you mind being called a tree hugger?
No, I don't mind being called a tree hugger. There's a connotation that has that, you know, we wear earrings and Birkenstocks and, you know, we don't take showers regularly or something like that. But, you know, Penn Future, at least, is an organization that's committed to protecting the environment at the same time making sure that we do policies that help to grow the economy and create really good jobs. And you know what? The Marcellus Shale issue is one of those issues I think that all that comes together in.
Yeah, I would love to see us go to a solar. I'd love to see us go to wind, geothermal, all of those things. Natural gas to me seems to be the bridge that will get us there from the old dirty fossil fuels of burning oil. I think this is that I'm hoping that this is that bridge that gets us to renewable energy.
Yeah, it can be a part of the answer and a part of the strategy that we use to actually transition to an economy based on clean renewable energy. But you know, we can't do it overnight. And natural gas can be a thing that can help us get towards that goal.
Right.
But you know, at the same time, the development of this huge valuable resource, which is going to make multi-billion-dollar corporations just really rich, because this is a really, really rich deposit, is going to have a big environmental footprint, and we're very concerned about that.
As we should be. I've been saying that this is the gold rush of our generation.
It certainly is.
And this notion that if we tax these companies coming in, the notion that if we put rules in place to protect our environment and to protect our workers, that somehow they're not going to come, seems to be me just plain wrong.
It is plain wrong. And here's what we say to the gas drillers. Welcome to Pennsylvania, but play by our rules and pay your fair share. One of the big issues that is right in front of us right now is we are trying to get a severance tax enacted on the extraction of the gas out of this very, very rich resource. The Marcellus Shale Formation is huge, and that's not the only gas deposit here in Pennsylvania. Under that, there's something called the Utica Formation. And if you take the entire sort of layers of geologic formations that we have that have gas in them all together, we're actually sitting on the biggest, maybe the biggest, gas deposit in the entire world. We're literally going to be the Saudi Arabia of gas.
Well, here's what I'd hope then. Since you're saying that we're going to be the Saudi Arabia, I would hope that we don't go along the Saudi Arabian path, which is you have a handful of princes and kings and an entire society full of paupers. I would hope that we would do at least what the good socialist state of Alaska has done, and try and distribute some of the money that comes out of the ground to the citizens of the state.
That's exactly what we're trying to do, and we've been working on this for 2 years, and we're down to the last minute of this game here. We're in the red zone. We are 1 yard from the goal line, and we are facing some serious roadblocks to getting this through. Partly because the gas industry has spent mountains of cash giving campaign contributions to elected officials and on lobbying. And anybody who wants to can look this up. The Common Cause has created a website where you can keep track of the gas driller money, and it's called MarcellusMoney.org. And you can see for yourself what they've been spending. And so far, it's been paid off. Right now, we are unsure whether or not we actually get this over the goal line. And if we don't do it now, the odds to get it done at all really plummet, as we don't know what the next administration is going to look like, and we don't know after the election what the Pennsylvania House and Senate are going to look like. So it's absolutely crucial to get this done now. We support a tax that raises a significant revenue, and that some of it is returned to the people of Pennsylvania into the general fund, so everybody in Pennsylvania can benefit from it. And it also comes back to programs that benefit the environment and gets returned to local communities that are dealing with the impacts of gas drilling, right in their communities.
Right.
So that's what we're working for. And, you know, the legislature made a promise when the budget was passed to do this by October 1st. And we're all about having them keep that promise. And right now, I'm not sure that that's actually going to happen, and people should be outraged about that. These gas drillers are going to make billions and billions of dollars. ExxonMobil paid $41 billion to get a stake in the Marcellus Shale gas deposit, to get a piece of that. So they know it's going to be highly profitable. One of the reasons it's so profitable is because it's really near, it's back down actually in the middle of Mark of the market for natural gas, the biggest market for natural gas almost in the world. And the transportation costs constitute half of the price of gas to the end consumer. And so they get this huge sort of discount when they sell their gas. They make a bigger profit because they don't have to ship it so far. The gas is extremely rich. There's no such thing as a dry hole. It is a phenomenal resource, and they're going to make billions of dollars. Now, they claim that they'll go out of state if they levy a severance tax, but the gas ain't going anywhere. Every other state that produces more gas than us has a severance tax, so it's not like they're going to be avoiding taxes, pulling their rigs and going somewhere else.
But it's a good talking point, though. I mean, it really is a good talking point to scare the people who really aren't paying attention and really don't know. So, oh my gosh, you know, they're not going to come. We're not going to get those jobs. We better give them what they want.
No, can't move the gas. This is a really profitable deposit. They're going to be coming here, and they're not going to go anywhere. There have been studies that have looked at the effect of severance taxes on gas production or production of other minerals, and they can come to the conclusion that there's practically no impact on production at all, and we wouldn't expect to see that here. Even when gas prices are low, this gas deposit is highly profitable for these companies.
Well, at
the other thing they say, let me tell you this, Rick, is that they're going to create all these great Pennsylvania jobs, and I think over time that they will. But right now, most of the jobs are taken up by these roughnecks from out of state. And the other thing to look at here is most of these are not union jobs. These are guys who are coming from out of state. They're from Oklahoma. They're from Texas. They're from Arkansas. They come up with the rigs. They put them up. They're here for 2 weeks at a time. They go home. They come back. You know, it's an itinerant workforce, and most of the jobs aren't union jobs. And that's actually becoming a point of contention here.
And it should be. I mean, these should be good quality, family-sustaining jobs for people locally. I have friends who live in some of the outer regions where the natural gas is being drilled, and they say the only two industries that are really doing well are the gas industry and the hotel industries, because the drilling companies are buying up all the rooms.
Yeah, and in some cases they've bought whole hotels to house their guys. And in some places, they've created these things called, that people up in that area, neck of the woods, are calling man camps, where it's kind of like a bunch of trailers where they bring their crews in and they put them up at those places close by to where the drilling sites are, and then get them out into the field every day. So right now, most of the jobs are not going to Pennsylvanians, and they're certainly not going to union members. There have been some suggestions, and I know some legislators have been thinking about trying to create incentives for the gas drillers to actually make sure that a good portion of the jobs go to union members. I know that there's been some talk about, you know, giving them some kind of a break on a severance tax, for example, if, say, 70-80% of their workers were hired were actually Pennsylvania residents and union members. I'm not sure where those discussions are right now, but it's certainly something that's caught the notice of some of our union friends.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Jan Jarrett. She's president of Penn Future. Their website, PennFuture.org. You know, the question that I get often: what does it matter who's working on those rigs? As long as there are people working and they're paying taxes in the Pennsylvania, why does it matter? And my response is, look, if I'm living in a neighborhood where they're drilling into the ground, I'm going to be more concerned about what they're doing environmentally. And this is where I want to pull this back to, what they're doing with the frack solution, what they're doing with the wastewater, and what they're doing to my neighborhood. At least that's the way I see it. Your thoughts?
I would completely agree. And the other thing that I think is important is that, you know, guys and men and women who are born in Pennsylvania are going to have a greater investment in making sure that their water is clean, that their air is clean, that they're not tearing up the countryside and ruining the places they like to hunt and fish. You know, we've seen the gas drillers, for instance, be able to lease half of the state forest land that lies over the Marcellus Shale gas deposit. And it just seems to me that if there were more Pennsylvanians on those crews, they would be more mindful of preserving, our natural heritage for their kids, you know?
Absolutely. What's interesting to me, though, is, you know, I look at the history of the coal industry And for me, the history of the coal industry is telling me what the history of the natural gas industry is going to be in 20, 30 years for my children.
Well, what we hope is that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. When this industry first really got up and running, I don't believe that regulators really understood how different it was from the shallow well gas drilling that we've had in Pennsylvania for decades. When they finally started to realize the huge environmental challenges it poses to the environment, the regulatory process kind of started to try to catch up with the technology and the industrial scale of what they've got to do to get at this Marcellus Shale deposit. It's a huge industrial process. It's got a great big environmental footprint, you know, five acres of cleared land and, you know, 5 to 6 wells on a particular pad and millions and 5 to 6 millions of gallons of water for each well that they drilled to do the fracking. And then, you know, millions of gallons of water that flow back in the form of wastewater that they have to actually take care of. So there have been some regulations that have been passed. One of them now requires the drillers, if they choose to dispose of their wastewater in our rivers or streams, they need to treat that to safe drinking water standards. There are new regulations that will soon be adopted that will require greater standards for the construction of the wells to make sure that they don't leak this frack fluid out into the aquifer or allow migration of methane, which has happened different places in Pennsylvania because of faulty well construction. So there's been a lot of catch-up that's been happening. The Department of Environmental Protection raised the permit fees in order to be able to hire more inspectors and permitters to try to get a handle on this. But still not enough. It's going to be an ongoing challenge for regulators. It's going to be an ongoing challenge for citizens who are dealing with this. And it's a new neighbor, and we're going to have to understand what this new neighbor is like. We're going to have to insist that this new neighbor behave itself. And we're just going to have to learn to deal with it. And, you know, we're also going to have to insist that the benefits that this industry brings to Pennsylvania gets shared widely among all Pennsylvania citizens, amongst communities where drilling is happening, and benefits our workers.
I absolutely agree. Last question I've got for you. You know, I've asked a number of people, do we know what's in this fracking solution? I've heard a couple of state reps say, well, yeah, we know. I've heard a couple of people say, no, we don't know because it's proprietary information. Do you know what's in this stuff?
Well, generally speaking, we do know what they're using. There's a list of chemicals that they are using that are posted on the DEP website. Two of the companies have, at least two, maybe three, but I know for sure that two have voluntarily stepped up, and they disclose exactly what they're using at each well and post it on their website. The two I know that are doing that are Range Resources and Chief Oil and Gas. So that if you live near a well, you can go onto the website and you can find what they're using in the concentrations they're using it. So the argument that it's proprietary is kind of out the window as these companies at least have decided to voluntarily disclose it. We think that should be a requirement of all of them.
I agree, but in looking at the chemicals that they're using, I'm told that a good number of them are carcinogens.
Yeah, they're toxic. They're using them in small amounts, but they are toxic. They've got to be handled extremely carefully. Certainly people like emergency responders, you know, first responders, like your local fire company, needs to know what's on those sites in case of some kind of an accident. So it's a real public need to know issue that we really need to know what's on these sites. It's got to be handled very carefully. They've got to you know, tell DEP exactly how they're going to handle all of that. We've actually helped to craft some legislation that would require cradle to grave accounting of all of this stuff. Where they're getting the water, what they're putting into it, and where they're taking it at the end of the day, and so we'd like to see something like that tightened up.
I would have liked to have seen them have done that before they stuck one needle into the ground.
Yeah, that would have been
much better.
That's not where we are.
No, Jan Jarrett, Penn Future is the group, PennFuture.org. Jan, always great to talk to you. Look forward to having you back real soon.
Okay, Rick. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
United we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Who's going on?
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. That's if you've got something on your mind. Factory farms are making you sick, according to the Corporate Crime Reporter. They're asking, let's count the ways. They point out recently that a half a billion eggs were recalled. Why? Salmonella poisoning. More than 1,300 people were sick. Another recall, more than 380,000 pounds of deli meat distributed nationwide to Walmart stores. Why? Contamination. The bacteria can cause listeriosis, a rare but potentially deadly disease. So they say, move over animal farm. Here comes animal factory. And the animal factories are dominating the agricultural landscape, making us sick and poisoning the environment. The Obama administration, which ran on a platform to confront factory farming, according to the Corporate Crime Reporter, has done little to confront the problem. David Kirby, author of the book Animal Factory, told the Corporate Crime Reporter that, quote, they don't have the stomach to take on the factory farms. They're gun-shy, and I'm disappointed. Well, you know, here's the thing. Stop and think about this for a minute. Think of all the problems Obama inherited when he took office. Think of all the problems. We're talking 30 years of this idea that corporations were going to police themselves. 30 years of economic destruction of the middle class. This guy cannot, I know the media propped him up. I know the media made Obama seem like Superman, but you know, there are only so many hours in the day and to put out so many different fires. And this is another one of them, one that I've been screaming about for a while. But again, this is something that you really can't go, well, Obama promised. Man, so many things to get to. The Corporate Crime Reporter says, while the Justice Department and the Department of Agriculture are holding hearings on concentration in agribusiness, Kirby sees the exercise as a glorified listening tour. He doesn't anticipate federal intervention to prevent a disaster. But, he says, what we need, what needs to be done is clear. Move from factory farms to family farms. That's how. And he asked the question, how? Well, you ban the non-therapeutic antibiotic use in animals. Ban it. Break up these big agribusinesses. Break up the cartels. Kirby says that there are so few processing plants now, and they're so centralized and big, they want to process only factory farm animals. Cut the billions to agribusiness subsidies, he says. And I'm in favor of that. Go take a look at the farm bill and cut them off at the knees. Say, enough is enough. Kirby goes on to say, and by the way, why aren't the Tea Partiers out there screaming about the billions of dollars we give away every year to these massive farms? He goes on to say, and then take some of the subsidies and give them to small, independent farmers who can really use it to compete. He says that the Obama administration ran on a platform to do some of these things, but they refused to take on agribusiness. And again, like I said, think about it for a second. You know, he's taken on Wall Street. He's taken on a lot of the big interests in this country. Agribusiness is one of those you just don't touch. They are immensely powerful. They're part of the reason, one of the bigger parts of the reason for our insane trade agreements. Because we want to push all of that, all of our agricultural goods out and destroy other people's markets. Look at Mexico. Look what we did to the Mexican economy. Once they passed NAFTA, man, our corn producers went in there and just wiped everybody out. There was no competition about it. We dumped and dumped and dumped, and we were subsidizing those industries to do it. But Kirby says, you know, here's the thing. He says it's going to take a disaster to change the system, and it's kind of my logic. You need to have chaos. You need to have disaster. You need to have collapse before people act. He says you can pass all the laws you want, organize all the boycotts you want. But ultimately, when you cram thousands of animals into a single confined space without access to fresh air, outdoor sunlight, pasture, natural animal behaviors, you're asking for the problems in the forms of disease that attack people. Mother Nature will have hit the last word. Mad cow disease was a warning. Swine flu was a warning. MRSA was a warning. And the egg recall was a warning. We haven't had the big one yet. Things are changing. He says he hopes that consumers are waking up. And look, we got to do something about our food supply. I'm in favor of local. I'm in favor of, you know, family farms. I'm in favor of the farmers markets. We've got to somehow take back the food, and we've got to stop with this. You know, the Europeans have the right idea. Stop with this genetically modified food. Stop it.
Well, we have another problem, Rick. This area has some great farmland, some literally from the area I'm in, where I live in the adjacent county, literally the county side of me, Lancaster County, some of their farmland is considered as good as any in the country. And you look around and you see these huge parcels of land. Where the
for sale.
And why? Generational thing. A lot of the younger generation don't want to put in the hours. They
I
don't
disagree.
Want to put in the hard. No, that's part of the problem.
I disagree.
And then you have developers come in and offering them huge, you know, you want to sell your land, we'll give you a huge amount of money. And they're selling, unfortunately.
Yeah, but here's the thing. If farming was more profitable, what's going on is we've targeted federal money to these big agribusinesses, and we've subsidized them, and we've basically squeezed out the small family farmers, squeezed them out. And we need to encourage that competition. The reason I bring this up on Tree Hugger Tuesday, what? You shook your head.
Well,
you gave me the Christ.
Well,
what?
No, I'm going like this because I think what you said is partly right, but I also know some profitable farms where, yes, it is hard work. I mean, you know, sometimes younger generation, maybe they want to be doctors. Maybe they want to be engineers. Maybe they don't want to farm anymore. That's understandable. What I'm saying is that there isn't just one reason. It is hard work.
No, I actually know a couple of people who want to get into farming. They just can't afford the land because they're competing with the developers that you're talking about. And it comes back to our zoning rules as well, which is why I was in favor of open space legislation that they tried to pass here that the building association shot down. You know, when you're looking at the price of land in this area and really across the country, it's outrageous because of how we've zoned this stuff. If you zone it for farming, it's going to be a lot cheaper. And people who want to farm, and I do know a couple of people who would love to get into farming other than the prohibitively expensive land, they would have that opportunity.
And there are some private organizations that are into farm preservation. But that's on a small level. But I think somewhere along the line we're going to have to really look at that problem, because let's be honest, the fewer farmers we have, the more expensive it's going to be, either in direct prices or the amount of money that we give the farmers and subs. Let's be honest, our food in this country, Rick, and I think you know this to be true, is comparatively cheap.
Well, it's comparatively cheap because we subsidize it.
Yes.
Because we have a massive farm bill. And B, we do an awful lot of genetic modification. And I look at this story that I came across today. It says, after two days of hearing, several members of an 11-member advisory panel of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration found that there are not yet sufficient data to determine that genetically modifications that enable salmon to grow twice as quickly is safe for the affected fish or for the consumer. So basically they go through this whole article and say, look, there's this company out there. They've figured out how to fiddle with the eggs. They're gonna pump some stuff into that. They're gonna fiddle with the eggs, and now these salmon grow twice as big, twice as fast. And the only information that the FDA is using is data from the company. Only on a handful of the fish that they did this to. And we're supposed to say, oh, okay, yeah, sure, sign me up for that monstrous fish that was genetically modified.
I saw that
Frankenfish.
I saw that news item, and those fish are monsters. Now, here's the thing, and one of the broadcasters mentioned, what if somehow one of those fish get out or a couple of those fish get out? I mean, they could actually go out and become huge predators. Is that a positive thing? I don't think so.
You know, it's one of those things when you start screwing around with stuff, where does it end up? You know, I understand, you know, crossbreeding, and I understand that. But when you start fiddling around with and adding chemicals and
that's right. And here's the thing: we really don't know the long term effects of this.
And when you're pumping stuff with steroids and you're doing all the, it kind of makes me wonder.
I mean, for the most part, I eat a lot of fish. I think it's healthy. But if we're going to get into the steroids and chemicals and that can lead to some severe problems long term. Again, it's all about profit.
Right. And I don't know, but you know, we're going to keep an eye on this. In fact, tomorrow we're going to talk to a woman from one of the groups fighting against it. Let's take a quick break. We're right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
The surge is on in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, the surge that appears to be most effective is not the 30,000 additional U.S. troops that President Obama has now poured into this hellacious war, but a wholly unexpected surge by the enemy. General David Petraeus' surge strategy was to concentrate our soldiers in the Afghan south and east, attacking the Taliban where they are strongest. The gleaming gemstone of this plan was to be the taking of Kandahar, Afghanistan's second largest city and the birthplace of the Taliban. This goal was supposed to have been achieved months ago, but, well, stuff happens. Or in this case, doesn't happen. The assault on Kandahar is finally underway, but meanwhile the Taliban has slipped away and is surging throughout the country, including in provinces that were previously Taliban-free. Indeed, 4 years ago, the enemy had strongholds in only four of Afghanistan's 34 provinces. Now, they're in 33 of them, and practically every independent observer of the war says that Afghanistan has become more dangerous than at any time since our 2001 invasion. It's so dangerous that election officials simply shut down hundreds of polling places in 25 provinces for September's parliamentary elections. And international observers could not even go into the rural areas where most Afghans live. This gave a free hand to warlords and political power brokers to commit a massive level of voting fraud that delegitimizes the national election. Even America's hawkish foreign policy establishment has begun arguing that this war is neither winnable nor worth the enormous costs we're paying in lives, money, and reputation. As one establishmentarian now flatly says, a U.S. military victory over the Taliban is simply not necessary to protect U.S. interests. This is Jim Hightower saying, bingo!
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled,
Swim against the current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
An old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. That's the number here. I got an email during the break, and if you want to email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. John writes, Rick, please, we get one calorie of food for every calorie of energy heating production. Before factory farms, we produced 10 calories of food for every calorie of energy used. Transport and oil-based fertilizers account for heaps of it. Local wins on every front. And, you know, my wife and I have had this conversation, you know, about you get these monster-sized apples where you see they're like pumpkin-sized apples. And you eat the thing, and it's like you're not really full. And I remember as a kid, you'd get those little, you know, tiny apples, and you'd eat one of those, and it was enough. So it seemed like there was more substance to it and less water. Does that make sense?
I haven't experienced that. I would imagine it does. I haven't, to be honest, experienced that.
Well, some are saying that what we're getting is we're getting bigger, shinier, happier products, but that they just look better. And the nutritional value, the nutrition, isn't what it used to be. Now, that could be, you know, just people looking back and saying, well, you know, when I was a kid, things were better. You know, could be that, but, you know, we've had that thought.
I try wherever possible to buy locally grown fruit. I think that's the best policy.
Corn sugar.
Okay.
That's what they've changed the name of high fructose corn syrup to. Corn sugar. I just want to make sure everyone knows that. So when you start seeing it on the label, you'll know that, hey, that used to be high fructose corn syrup. There's an interesting story. Every business is looking for new growth areas. The Teamsters apparently are no different. One of the country's most storied unions has signed up to close to 40 new members this month by organizing the nation's very first group of unionized marijuana growers. That's right. There are now actually pot growers who are union members. The new members work as gardeners and trimmers for Margian Investments, LLC, out of Oakland, California. The company holds contracts with medical marijuana patients to grow their pot for them. Their Teamster organizer, Lou Marchetti, said, quote, I didn't have this planned out when I became a Teamster 34 years ago to organize marijuana workers. He says this is a whole new ballgame. Along with the new two-year contract comes a pension, paid vacation, health insurance, and wages that jump from the current $18 per hour up to $25.75 an hour within 15 months.
I have to ask the question, right? And you know where I'm going with this one. There's a famous brewery down around where you used to live in Allentown that you could drink all the beer you wanted as long as you worked there and you did it on your breaks. And where I worked, I could eat all the candy I want. I wonder if those marijuana workers can partake of what they make.
Pot brownies, anyone?
Well, let's have a marijuana break. Let's stoke up a doobie.
I guess now if you got a wife who, let's see, if you got a wife that works at the chocolate factory, you got, you know, a relative that works at the beer place and somebody who works at the pot place, you're set. There's a party.
You could have a beer and a chocolate chip cookie.
And a chocolate brownie with pot in it.
There you go.
Marchetti told the Associated Press that the union would have not gotten involved with the growers if it didn't believe the business was legitimate under state law. He said, and you know, a lot of people have gotten funny ha-has out of this, but that the Teamsters would never organize an illegal business. if you know anything about the history, there's always been some claims. And look, as a 20-plus year Teamster, I have never seen any illegal activity within my union. They have always been one of the most, in my opinion and in my experience, one of the most upfront unions, one of the most democratic unions. And I still think it's a funny statement.
No, it is. But it sounds like they have a decent contract.
Oh, geez. In this economy, to go from $18 up to $25.75 in 15 months, that is a booming business. That is a booming business. Some of the comments against it, though, were, I guess the unions are going to force pot sales back onto the black market, and their involvement will only make the leg production unaffordable. So basically they're saying that that the unions, by paying these people a decent wage, it's going to make pot unaffordable. You know, uh-huh. I often wonder...
What world do these people live in?
Exactly. And another comment I thought was funny, they haven't even legalized it, and they're handing out more pensions. And again, you know, I wonder about the guy writing this. I wonder if he has a pension. I would bet my last dollar that he doesn't.
Do you think this is one of these guys that drives a truck with a rifle in the back by the name of Bubba?
No, I just think he's one of these people who's just brain dead. Anyway, Fox News got caught again doing some creative editing. Do we have that clip available for the Fox News? Again, you know, if you remember back, you know, during the Tea Party things, you saw the you know, Fox used that clip of the rally. Half of the people were in bikinis and half the people were in parkas. You know, there were different shots. Oh, and here's a bright, cloudy, bright, sunny day with people in bikinis. And over on this side of the mall, there are these people, you know, with the snow coming down and parkas on. But they're all in the same place because most people didn't even realize and don't pay attention. But thankfully, somebody's paying attention. Here's the clip.
President Obama still refuses to budge on extending the Bush-era tax cuts for the most successful people in America and small business owners as well.
It is an irresponsible thing for us to do. I can't give tax cuts to the top 2% of Americans.
Why not?
Why not? Here's the why not. One, if you listen to the break in between, a little creative editing there, Jake. The last statement, I cannot give tax cuts to the top 2% of Americans, the rest of the sentence was 86% of that going to Americans making $1 million or more and lower the deficit at the same time. He said, I just don't have the math. So if you listen to the first part of the clip, well, I can't give tax cuts to the top 2% of Americans because I'm fighting a class war. No, he's saying, look, I just can't do it. The math doesn't add up. 86% of the money that is in these tax cuts is going to the top 2%. People who make $1 million or more a year.
And that's what doesn't make sense. I mean, they take the ideology away. The $1.2 billion that we gave them certainly helped to get us in the mess we are, but right now, let's even forget that. Right now, we're in a hole. We're in a hole. We can't afford to extend the tax breaks. Forget about the ideology. Forget about if it creates jobs or not. I don't think it created an awful lot of jobs.
Didn't create
but
any
that's
jobs.
That's another subject for another day. Let's just look at the practical situation. President finds himself. We're looking for every dollar we can save now. Now we're going to extend these tax breaks that were questionable in the first place. Makes no sense from a practical standpoint.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Should we be extending tax cuts to the wealthiest people in this country? Even though we know it's not going to create jobs, we know that money's not going to be invested in this country. Should we be handing back those tax breaks? Even though if we extend the tax benefits for 98% of the people in this country, the top is still going to get a benefit because the lower rates are lower. They're still getting a benefit check. It's just not the massive benefit that they got under the Bush tax cuts. Now, think about this for a second. All of the rates are lowered except that very top rate. So getting up to that top rate is a longer climb. You're able to make more money. You're able to keep more until you get to that top rate. And look, at the end of this, the people who are making $1 million a year, do you think they're out there swinging a hammer? Do you think they're out there producing things? No. They're sitting on their behinds collecting dividends check. Oh, no, well, wait a minute. They're captains of industry. They're the ones who are moving jobs overseas half the time. And half the money that they make comes because, hey, well, we got a bonus because we move those jobs overseas. Like the statistics show, 42%. Increases in their salaries for CEOs who move jobs overseas. 42% increase in their compensation.
Well, to get back to this tax breaks, you know, I haven't seen any legitimate studies that have said that it created jobs, that it was worthwhile. Have you? Other than their argument of from a philosophical standpoint.
There is
haven't
nothing.
Seen any. There aren't any.
Nothing. And when we come back from the break, we're going to pick this up on the other side because I think it's important. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provided for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Hello, I'm David Fillman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Let's have a tea party like the growers do. We'll serve the finest tea and fancy cookies too. Let's go to the neighborhood inviting everyone. Let's have a tea party, won't it be fun?
Oh, the fancy cookies. Oh, boy. You know, and I know, Jake, I know you go to every event that has cookies. Have you been to a tea party with cookies?
I have not. If you know of any, let me know. I'd be willing to go there and give a report on tea party cookies.
There you go. And what's interesting to me, though, in talking about the tea party, is that you see these people out there with their misspelled signs and their bizarre slogans defending the top 2%, saying, well, we need to give tax cuts to the top 2%. We're going to fight and Obama's a socialist. When the reality is 98% of the people in this country have gotten tax breaks. And that's what he wants to save here. He said, look, you know, understand who spends the money. If you want an economy to get moving, you've got to understand who is spending the money. And it's not the Warren Buffetts of the world. It's Joe Sixpack down the street who needs new windows or who needs, you know, a new car or needs a new refrigerator. It's all these people who need things. That's how an economy grows. What we need is we need manufacturing policy that encourages domestic production for domestic consumption. That would be nice to see, but tax policy is a good start. And as the president has said, look, if you make less than $200,000 as an individual or you and your spouse make less than $250,000, you'll see no change. Nothing. Nothing. And I wonder how many of the people marching with the misspelled signs and the bad slogans, maybe with, you know, the pretending to draw the wagon while being whipped by a guy with an Obama mask. I wonder how many of those people make more than $200,000 a year. And they love to say, oh, wow, you're punishing small business. You're punishing small business. Well, honestly and truthfully, small business, if you're making $200,000 a year in a small business, you're pretty damn successful. Because that's after all your costs. That's 200 grand pure profit. I mean, pulling 200 grand in revenue is not hard to do. But putting 200 grand in your pocket from a small business, that is hard to do. And that's something that we're not hearing the mainstream media talk about. And in the clip that we played last segment, you know, the guy goes, well, you know, that's small businesses. You know, of course, there's the really wealthy people, but small businesses. That's the anchor. That's the thing that's supposed to get middle class people all enraged, because we've bought into this fallacy that small business is the great job creator. And it's really not. What you need are growing businesses. You know, I can start a business and hire one guy. Is that really job creation? And is that job going to be one that person can make a living on? A family sustaining living? I don't know. The numbers that I've seen, and Ruth Marcos did a piece over the weekend about small businesses, that it was brilliant. It's saying, look, you know, our misguided belief in the small business model, that they're the ones that create all the jobs. A little fantasy there. What we need is we need demand. We need to turn this thing around and stop trying to stimulate the economy by propping up failed business. By propping up failed Wall Street and get people buying stuff. Put money in their pocket with targeted tax cuts for working people. And I would say even people up to $200,000 is still too high. I would say have massive tax cuts for people making under 100 grand a year. Because that's where the vast majority of people in this country are. Target that, because those are the people who spend the money. It's that simple for me.
I think you're absolutely right. If I can make a comment on small business, I mean, we can dicker about at what amount do they go from small business to maybe medium size. I mean, what the average person, I don't think, understands is how small business is run. They take advantage of a lot of tax breaks. Now, some of them tax breaks are legitimate. They take the profits and invest back into the business, but some of them, you know, really, they're just hiding it, and it's really income, and they're just what I'm saying is basically reflecting what you're saying. If you're making a profit of $250,000, clear profit, after all the deductions and all the hiding, and you're reporting on your income tax, you're probably not a small business.
I mean, look at Christine O'Donnell. You want to go back to the Tea Party woman. She reported income of $5,800. How did she live? How did she live? How did she pay her rent? How did she pay her electric bill? How did she pay her phone bill? How did she pay her cell phone bill? How did she pay a car payment? How did she put gas in the car? How did she put food on the table? How did she put those fancy duds on her back? How did she do a lot of those things?
It's about $115 a week.
On $115 a week, how do you do that? Well, I guess the answer is you steal campaign funds and you fund your life. Much like, you know, Sarah Palin. How does she dress so nice on such a limited income? Well, $150,000 from the RNC sure buys a lot of clothes on Saks Fifth Avenue. Doesn't it?
Sure does. You betcha.
You betcha. Well, you know it's campaign season. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said Monday that the United States, and get ready, hold your hats, the United States must be prepared to use military force to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, and added that the last resort step should be taken with the goal of overthrowing Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Graham, a military lawyer and senior Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, became the first senator to support the direct U.S. military intervention into Iran, saying it should not involve ground troops, but be launched by U.S. warplanes and ships. Okay. He went on to say, if you use military force against Iran, you've opened up Pandora's box. This is what he told the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. If you allow Iran to get nuclear weapons, you've emptied Pandora's box. I'd rather open up Pandora's box than empty it. You know, here we go. It must be election time. We need to figure out how we're going to get...
Hey, look. I mean, let's be honest here. Let's be honest. If Iran's really set on coming up with nuclear weapons, I'm not so sure we can stop them.
I think we can. I think we can stop them if...
I'm talking short of a nuclear or an invasion.
I think Colin Powell had the right idea. Say, look, they want to develop nuclear energy technology. You bring in the Chinese, you bring in the Russians, you have them broker a deal that's going to make it almost impossible for them to do anything else. You set up strong inspections. At this point, I don't know that we can do what he's talking about.
Are you talking the carrot and stick approach?
Of course, you have to.
Offer them incentives to not go further?
You know, believe but verify. You know, say you've got to be right there watching every step of the way. If truly they want nuclear technology for energy, that's one thing. You need to have the inspectors in there. You need to have people keeping a watchful eye. And you've got to bring in the Chinese and the Russians. It's that simple. It's that simple for me. Let's go to the phone lines. We got Jim on line one. How are we doing today, Jim?
Hey, Rick. How you doing?
I'm great, and I'm getting better every minute of the day.
I believe it. You know, I grew up in South Carolina. And I understand the mentality of some of the people that Lindsey Graham represents. And I'm afraid it's not at the very top of the heap.
Yeah.
And for him to make a suggestion like that, well, it's just absolutely crazy. I mean, did we not go into Iran back in the 50s when we overthrew Milosevic, when the CIA went in there and installed the Shah?
Yep. Yeah, you're right.
And, of course, what did the Shah use? The Savak, his secret police, which terrorized that country to the point that it created the revolution with Khomeini. And, you know, this is just crazy talk. I don't know why people are saying stuff like this when they have the lessons of history to, you know, look back upon.
Well, it's crazy talk because and it's election time, so he's got to be out there posturing. He wants to prop up, you know, some of his candidates. And look, who knows what's on this guy's mind? But at the end of it, it's not going to be him out there bleeding and dying. It's not going to be his children. It's going to be the poor people of this country. It's going to be the working people of this country who shed blood over this.
Well, not only that, but, you know, as far as the international situation is concerned, you're going to create an even nastier hornet's nest than was there before. I mean, the reason we have this problem in Iran with Ahmadinejad is because of our history with that country.
Yep.
And, of course, when we created that Frankenstein monster over there.
Yeah, we sure did, Jim. Yep, Jim, I got to take a break right here. I appreciate the call, buddy. Could you call back a little bit later, maybe? I hate the clock. We're right back after this. Sorry.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A solid majority of voters in election battleground states want to extend tax cuts for the middle class while ending them for people with incomes of more than $250,000 a year. The Greenberg Quinlan Rosner research firm conducted the poll in seven battleground states for the Service Employees International Union. The poll was conducted in California, Colorado, Illinois, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Washington, and Wisconsin. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says the poll shows that Americans of all stripes agree that working families and small business, not the wealthy, need and deserve tax cuts. The International Association of Machinists is looking at October 14th as a start date for a vote at Delta that could see 14,000 baggage handlers unionized. Jesse Russell reports.
The National Mediation Board announced the election date on Tuesday and said it will run until November 18th. The vote will include workers who are already unionized but came on board when Delta and Northwest merged in 2008. An additional date is expected to be announced for gate workers at Delta. They would also be represented by the IAM if the vote results in the affirmative. Flight attendants will start voting for or against union representation on September 29th, with the results expected on November 3rd. According to numbers released by the U.S. Department of Transportation's Bureau of Transportation Statistics on Tuesday, Delta now has the most full-time employees of any airline, increasing its staff in July by 5.7%. That increase is mostly due to the merger with Northwest.
The International Longshore and Warehouse Union is out with a report on Rite Aid drugstores criticizing what the union says is mismanagement under new owners. The report, Navigating Rough Waters, Can New Management Steer Rite Aid Back on Course?, is being distributed to stock analysts, financial advisors, and industry trade reporters as Rite Aid prepares to issue its quarterly financial report. The union says Rite Aid management is trying to solve its financial problems on the backs of its workers. Workers at Rite Aid warehouse operations are struggling for union recognition, basic rights, and a voice at work. Workers at a Lancaster, California Rite Aid warehouse began a union organizing effort in 2006. They won an NLRB election in 2008 and have been negotiating with management for a first contract ever since. The union says instead of bargaining in good faith to agree on a contract, Rite Aid management has been engaged instead in a needless conflict with its workers. An increase in the consumer price index will see a slight raise for Oregon's minimum wage come January. The state's minimum wage will bump up from $8.40 per hour to $8.50 an hour, thanks to that state's minimum wage being tied to the index. The index rose by 1% last month. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.com. Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. For the longest time, I've been calling for national leaders to stand up and really to fight back against the fake AstroTurf groups funding the teapot groups and the Beckites, really. The one thing that we have seen is the handfuls of loud, obnoxious fringe groups in the streets with their misspelled signs and their illogical slogans. And the media has sucked up every bit of it. Well, I got to tell you, it's time for sane people in the room to take back the message, to restore actual honor and respect to our national discourse. And I've got Bill George in the studio, President Emeritus of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, here to inject a little hope into this election cycle. Bill, welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to be back. And Rick, it's great. I'm glad to see you in the in heaven now, working in the AFL-CIO office building. We're on the second, in between the first and second floor. It's good to be here. Yes, sir. It's good to talk to your great listeners and people who really believe in what America's about, especially believing in working Americans.
Well, what we keep hearing from the media is that Democrats are down and organized labor is down on the president, down on the Democratic Party, and that Republicans are basically just going to steamroll over everybody, and it's the Tea Party who's going to steam over everyone.
Well, the fact of the matter is there's two reasons for that. One is the media in a lot of areas is owned by conservative Republicans. I mean, Murdoch owns this. He's given a couple $1 million to Republican Governors Association out of his own pocket, and so a lot of the media is owned by brokers and White House, rich people who have an influence that want to hypnotize America to sleep. But at the same time, I think there's I'm optimistic about it. You know, Robin Hood was a down and out guy, and so was Gandhi and a guy named Jesus. These are guys who are down and out. You know, but when you talk straight and you're honest with people and you lay it out there, and even those tough times and sacrifices, a great nation doesn't come out of lies and deceit and phoniness. It comes out of honesty, and sometimes that honesty isn't always good news, but at least honesty and integrity, and that's what made this flag and this nation so great. It wasn't the rich, the wealthy, and the Wall Street guys that are playing the game and their philanthropists that try to buy their honor back again. And it's about the people, and it's really an election about the working people in this country. And if you're a working person, whether you're a union and you're not, you need to really put your feet on the ground. You need to really listen and evaluate. And that's what's great about this country. You got a right to make a decision and do not get influenced by phony people, the Three Stooges, I call them, Beck, O'Reilly, and the other guy,
Limbaugh.
You know, I call them the Three Stooges. In fact, it's picking up a little bit of steam. Somebody heard of my Facebook in Chicago, and they're running it on our news, the Three Stooges, and, you know, the top entertainers of our country. And they don't make any bones about it. They're not there to be factual or be honest. They're there to make money and tell people lies and deceit. That's why they listen to them.
But what's odd about it is they are honest. And when Limbaugh comes out and says, I am the defender of corporate America, his listeners let that go in one ear and out the other.
Yeah, but they need to listen to him when he said time and time again here in the last year. I guess they made him cut it off that before he accepts Obama as a success in the White House for this country, he would rather see this country fell. And he said it enough times where somebody, a producer or the network people, woke up and says, well, geez, you're talking like a traitor. You mean because you don't like the president, you want to see this nation fail? You know, I mean, what kind of people listen to somebody like that? You know, we get mad at these religious people who misguide their people, and here we got an announcer saying, I'd rather see America fail before Obama's a success. To me, that's a traitor. When you say, I'd rather see the president fail, there's something wrong with you. And as far as I'm concerned, people listen to him and vote by what he says, then they deserve what comes out of that, which is where we're heading now, and the more of it.
Yeah, I used to believe that. I used to believe that, you know, if someone was dumb enough to follow stupid principles or dumb ideas, they deserve what they get. But the problem here, Bill, is there seems to be such a large number of them that they're going to take us down, the rational people with them.
Well, I don't know about that.
Look at Christine O'Donnell for a second. Christine O'Donnell was elected to run for the Republican
nomination.
But
you got to stop this. She ran a Republican. She was inside a tunnel. inside a tunnel means that nobody, the whole general public couldn't vote for her. She was a Republican within that Republican club. That club's made up of moderates and conservatives and liberals within the Republican Party. And yes, the dissatisfied people joined the ultra-right and they elected her. But I don't think that gets close to a lot of the Republicans that don't want to have any part of her. And doesn't surely, I would hope that the other civil-minded people in the country, whether Democrats or independents, realize what this is about. And you know, we get crazy things like in our history shows this, that we all get a little crazy when things get tough. They get a little bit wacky economically. And the economy interruption, creates panic in our households, creates disasters in marriages, creates chaos on the streets that we live in. And that's what we have here. When the Bush-Cheney-Santorum team left Washington, D.C., they left an empty bag. They left all kind of debt laying around. They left a war that they had no control of. And the two wars they left control of, they left us in debt. They left us high unemployment. 700,000 jobs a month was being lost. I mean, it's just epic. And it's still bad. We haven't bounced back yet. So people are mad about this thing. And so whoever's the title of anything, they're mad about. I mean, people go to work and get laid off. They get mad at the plant manager. They get mad at their foreman. We have people killing people at work sites at a greater degree than we ever had before because of this economic struggle we're in. And that's what's happening in this country. These three stooges are playing with serious, serious stuff. They're playing with families' emotions. They're playing with domestic problems. They're playing with injustices to certain sectors of our society based on religion. They're playing with all kind of turmoil. They're sitting back at their country club and their yachts laughing about it, smoking a cigar about what they did yesterday on radio. I mean, do people understand that these three stooges, when they go home, they got chauffeurs and they live in castles and they got yachts and they got five or six different houses here? That how they're using it? I mean, that's the funny part about it. That's what I laugh about them, because they sit around and they don't even believe what they're saying themselves. And they tell their neighbors that. And they tell people, but take it easy. I'm only an entertainer here. I got to sell commercials. So that's what they're about. But I think what's happening here in the last few weeks, what I've seen since I've been back, and I come back because I'm upset. People know that I stepped down and from the presidency of the AFL-CIO last spring, and Rick Bloomingdale and Frank Snyder's doing a great job. I came back because all the lies and deceits that I'm seeing on TV, I come back to fight. I'm not going to sit back and let these three stooges or the Republican Party, the new Republican Party, the new right-wing party. You know, it's kind of sad about Republicans. What they don't want to tell you is that either you become an ultra-right Tea Party fascist Republican, or there's no room for you. Well, that's what the message is in these upsets in these elections. I mean, when you look at the turnout, it's the mean, the racism, the hatred that's coming out of this Republican Party. People need to know if these people win, they're going to rule your state. They're going to rule your Senate district. They're going to rule the Congress. And if that's what you want, then you got to be prepared for it, Mr. America. I got to tell you, especially working America, because they're going to kick you back. These Tea Party people are about the rich, the elitists. They're sponsored by Wall Street people. I know Roger Meekin myself in Pittsburgh. He's a big giant investor and plays the stocks and dividends. Okay, and his whole Tea Party is about don't touch Wall Street, don't make no rules, don't make no regulations. Don't worry about the people who fail or don't fail. Let's have a free market. That's what Toomey's about. Toomey's about free market. Toomey is being sponsored by the Wall Street big giants and Goldman Sachs and every other major broker firm in this country, simply because they're targeting for one thing. Rick Santorum got $27 million in the Senate campaign from the rich and the wealthy in Wall Street because they targeted one thing. They target one thing, and here's the news what they're targeting. They're targeting the excess in Social Security. They need to add volume to Wall Street, and the only way they can add volume is go after the giant chunk anywhere from $2.7 trillion to $6 trillion. That's what Toomey's mission is. That's what his mission is to go after that excess dollars in Social Security. People need to know that Wall Street can't stay stagnant. They have to have volume growth. When I graduated high school, it was 850 million shares all year. They do 1.2 billion a day in exchanging shares just on the Dow, and another billion on the Nasdaq. they can't live. The next 3 or 4 years, they got to move that to $2 billion a day. Yeah. And when the wealth isn't out there, you got to find out where the wealth's at. And it's sitting over there in reserves at $2.6 trillion in reserves in Social Security and daily action in and out of Social Security of another $6 trillion.
It's so interesting you bring that up, though, because today on the Club for Growth website, all about privatizing Social Security.
Sure.
And who was the former head of the Club for Growth? The guy who could possibly be our U.S. Senator Pat Toomey.
That's right.
So when he runs around saying, look,
He made $1 million a year. They paid him $1 million a year in monies, bonuses, and stocks, and free rent, and cars, and et cetera. $1 million a year. That committee is all about Wall Street going after Social Security. And once you say, I'll do that for you, Wall Street, they give you blank checks, and that's what he's running on, blank check.
But he's saying he doesn't want to privatize Social Security.
Well,
but his group, the one that he was...
He's on the record in Congress, when he was in Congress, saying that he spoke different speeches all over the state of Pennsylvania, this country, about privatizing Social Security. And people will need to know when he says that, who is in the audience? It's your local broker. It's your local stock person. It's the people that had to belong to these mutual funds and et cetera. They're his hero, man. That's my baby. Okay, free market. That's how we make a living. And so it's natural for them to be in the capitalist society advocating that Wall Street take over the White House, take over Congress. And when that happens, people need to understand that your pension, your wages, your benefits, your health care, et cetera, becomes a no, no, no. You need to understand this battle in this country has been going on for over 100 years, that the more benefits an employer gives to its employees, the more raises it gives, the madder the shareholders get for that employer doing it. It's second grade. It's kindergarten stuff. And now it's out in the open with the Tea Party. That's what we're about. More shares, more dividends, and our wealth. We are the owners of this country, they say, and you're going to go back to an at-will society. You're going to do what we want you to do at will. And if people want to live in that kind of atmosphere, fine. I mean, I got to tell you, though, we've been there before. We've been there before the Depression. We've been there during the Depression. We've been there during World War I when they lived in the elitist world and the rest of us and our sons and daughters were getting killed. You need to understand what this is about. And when I talk, Billy George is creating a class war. I didn't create this class war. The rich, the elitists created this class war. When Wall Street lost over $2 trillion in shares and dividends in this country, we can't find $1.5 trillion that belong to the people within Wall Street today. And no answers on people's mortgages, no answers on anything that's taken place because there was no rules and regulations. You need to understand who the enemy is. The enemy is saying it's us, the rich, and we're going to take over, and that's the way it's going to be.
So the question is, Bill, is how we've seen the Tea Parties get their handfuls of people out into the streets and create a squeaky wheel scenario. How do we, on the rational side of things, how do we take that back? How do we get our side out into the streets? Because I do believe this has to happen in the street.
The Tea Party and the ultra-right in this country and the wealthy it was below them to do common things and go to the street and protest.
Well, they paid somebody. They're paying the Tea Party to do that.
But they themselves, they wouldn't even do that because they thought that was beyond them. Now, because of the simple fact that they claim they want their wealth back, they want everything back, is that they're paying people to do this. They are going out themselves, and the tactics they're using is similar to what we've done in this country as workers. Finally, they starved us so much during the Depression that we finally went to the streets. Companies and corporations exploited workers and abused workers so bad they took it to the street. And so it's in the street where this election is going to be won. And for many of us that think that this country is in bad shape and is in much pain as they are, but understand that we're not going to go back to where we were to fix it, that we got to move forward, we need to go to the street.
Absolutely.
Okay, workers got to go to the street. And precinct committee people, Democratic precinct committee people do. And true Christians got to go to the street and fight and stand up for what's right and what's wrong. And not say that you don't belong in this country because you don't belong with us. You don't believe in the same thing. We need to have this debate in a civil manner in which we're not having it. And I think we need to put what we're all about in this country first, regardless of what side you're on. And it's time for workers who really, really think that their new dream in the future, the dream for the future, is what it's about, not the bad dream that you had in the past. People need to say, if you're going to go to dream tonight, if you're going to go to sleep tonight and have a great dream, you want to have a great dream about the future, or you want to have a bad dream about the past? And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to create the Tea Party as if they had nothing to do with the recession, that Bush had nothing to do with the recession, that his vice president, Cheney, and his corporation had nothing to do with it. And maybe they didn't. Maybe they just turned their back on rules and regulations in Wall Street and what was happening with the mortgages and the homes and et cetera. They just didn't pay any attention to it.
Oh, they were collecting payoffs.
I mean, we had attack on 9/11, and the president sat there, and when he was told that, he just sat there for another eight or ten more minutes and talked to little kids in the classroom reading a book. And it hit him after 10 minutes. Well, geez, you know, there's something going on.
Maybe I should do something.
The same way with Katrina. They don't do it. You got to understand, when the wealthy, something happens in this country to the masses of people and the common people, the wealthy don't care. The wealthy don't care. They live in gated communities. They got their own roads, their own fire department, their own police department, and they got their own schools. They don't care about you, Mr. Public. The Tea Party don't care about you. They want to build bigger and better gated communities. So this is a class war, this election. It's time up for American workers, whether union or non-union. You go out there and you work every day, or unfortunately you're laid off. You need to get off your hind end and go out there and say, look, I may not like what's happening here right now, but I'm not going back, and I'm not going to go for Toomey, and I'm not going to go for Corbett, and I'm not going for these idiots running for Congress and everybody that are talking about, you know, lining up unions, people, and shooting them and blaming everything on social responsibility that we're so proud about in this country. Including Social Security. I'm proud about Social Security. It's the greatest social insurance program that's ever existed in the world.
But Bill, it's been failing for 75 years.
It's never failed. Not one person
ever. It's been
failing.
The sky's falling. Next year it's over.
Okay.
For 75 years, it's over next year.
1,000% successful. Not one person, not one, that was ever told you're entitled to Social Security didn't get their money. I want that person, if somebody knows, when they were told you're entitled to it, you meet the minimum requirement, here's what you're going to get, that they didn't get their check.
Good point.
It's as solid as gold. It's more valuable than gold. Gold is per pound, per ounce. It's solid than anything else. And when people say it's in trouble, they're phony. We're not in trouble until 2039. And even at that time, for the next 20 years after that, if you did nothing, you still get 80% of what you're entitled to under Social Security. So it's got, you know, people said that to people who went to work in the 50s. When I started in the mill, guys were retiring saying, I'm getting my Social Security. You never have to worry about it. It's not going to be there for you. It's never going to be there for you. Okay, and that scared
like
me
saying,
a little bit. 75
too.
I started
years.
Thinking, well, maybe I should get rid of it because it ain't going to be there for me. But when I keep looking back for that, I look at the record, you turn the page and you dig in the record and you see the millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people that became entitled to it because of age or disability or orphans' disability monies or whatever they're entitled to under Social Security, they got it. And they're still getting it. People by the thousands per day are signing up for Social Security, and if they meet the requirements and they're entitled to it, they get it, and they get it for life. Not one person's ever been cheated. It's the only solid thing we have in this country, the only great thing we got proud where there hasn't been corruption, because we kept it out of the private sector. You know how much corruption will take place, the same much that took place in, we got these people, what do they call, 401ks, you remember that one?
200.5.
Or the saving and loan industry. Well, if the Tea Party's back again, we're back again, we're going to do Wall Street again, we're going to do the savings and loans again, we're going to do the 401ks again, just give us your money, you suckers, don't worry about it, you know, we'll take care of you, yeah, you took care of us. You took care of us. Social Security takes care of us.
Absolutely.
Privatization is a failure in this country. And I take anybody in any argument in any sector of privatization, whether it's schools versus road maintenance or such, it's a failure. They hate to admit to it. It's part of our recession, causing our recession, driving up prices, driving up waste. Privatization in this country has caused more waste than any social public entity that we had in history.
5 years I've been asking people, show me one thing we've privatized that's actually benefited we, the working people. Last question.
How about deregulation, man? They brag, all deregulation, you're all going to get make your money. We're going to have better prices. Airline prices are going to be reduced. Your health insurance is going to be reduced. All this, give us deregulation. Let us deregulate gas industry. Let us deregulate the industry. How's your bills, Mr. America? Look at these guys, the new guys in town called the greedy, the Marcell's gas company, huh? They paying anything? All free gas in Pennsylvania, suckers. All free. They ain't paying one penny. 2 years running now. The biggest gas find in the world. There's more gas in Pennsylvania that they have found than they have found oil in Saudi Arabia. That's how big it is. One well can support the city of Pittsburgh for 30 years. One well. And they anticipate thousands and thousands and thousands of wells, and there's thousands already going in Pennsylvania. And you got nothing for it, Mr. Pennsylvania Public.
And we got nothing. So let me ask you, got about a minute left. What are you doing to get people out? I mean, pure energy here. You wanted coffee to start. I don't think you need it.
Well, but since I'm not the president anymore, my straps are off me. My chains are off me. Okay, if some other people in our club want to get mad at me, let them get mad at me. I'm going to go out there and swing like I never swung before. I'm going to get up early in the morning. I'm going to knock on people's doors. I'm going to be at plant gates. I'm going to pass literature out. I want confrontation in reference to good, solid discussions so we can educate them. I'm going to be doing radio shows. I'm going to be doing work sites. We're going to be doing phone banks. We're going to be doing everything that we can. We're going to get out there and talk to the public. We're going to take this. We're going to beat the Tea Party across this country because they're liars and they're cheats and they're greedy people. Not even what America's about. America's about working families trying to struggle in order to get forward and for us and our society, the government and business to help working in middle America. Rebuild middle America. Let's rebuild it, not with the Tea Party, and become pawns for them. Let's build a new middle America that has value and integrity and honesty and justice. That's what it's about. And let's have some dignity for working men and women all over this great country of ours, whether a union or not. I'm tired of getting a backhand from these big corporations and insurance companies, giving the workers the back of the hand. Stand together, workers. Stand together. It's your time. Take on the Tea Party. Let's win.
Amen. Bill George, President Emeritus of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Thanks for your time, and you are welcome back anytime.
Thank you, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
In 1927, 800 miners in the captive company town of Rossiter, located in Pennsylvania's Indiana County, joined a nationwide bituminous coal miner strike. From the start, Judge Jonathan Langham began issuing the most drastic injunctions imaginable against the workers and their union, the United Mine Workers of America. These injunctions prohibited miners from taking part in any picketing, marching, assembly for meetings and rallies, posting of signs, or giving any type of aid or comfort to the striking miners or their families. The miners were even prohibited from putting ads in the newspaper. The most outrageous of Langham injunctions received national attention. Judge Jonathan Langham ruled that workers were prohibited from holding prayer services and singing of hymns, described as hostile songs, at the Magyar Presbyterian Church, which was the only property in town not owned by the Clearfield Bituminous Coal Corporation. Striking miners were evicted from their company-owned homes and forced to live in tent colonies. Conditions were so poor that nearly one out of every 10 babies died at birth. Reports of these deplorable conditions were the basis of a U.S. Senate investigation into the conditions of the coal fields and company towns in Pennsylvania. The investigations were led by New York Senator Robert Wagner, who later sponsored the bill creating the National Labor Relations Act, otherwise known as the Wagner Act of 1935. Senator Wagner said of the conditions he found, quote, "Had I not seen it myself, I would not have believed that in the United States there were large areas where civil government was supplanted by a system that can only be compared with ancient feudalism. The sacrifices by these workers and fights for democracy by the Rossiter citizens helped change the social and political attitudes for the century to follow. It was these deadly fights and grave sacrifices by those who came before that allow us to live so well today." The tombstone of one of such worker reads, "40 years I worked with pick and drill down in the mine against my will. The coal king's slave, but now it's past. Thanks be to God, I am free at last." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Time for change.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me. Well, speaking of the GOP hit squad over at the Chamber of Commerce, our quote of the day comes from their hand-picked senatorial candidate, Pat Toomey. He said, quote, "I object to the term privatization. I think it's a misleading term. It's been used by the left to demagogue the issue and to completely miss people about the kind of reforms to Social Security that people like me have been advocating." And, you know, I go back to this. You know, you can change whatever name you want to use. It's like the conservative movement. It's had more facelifts than Joan Rivers. This privatization issue has had more name changes than Joan Rivers has had facelifts. And this is what they're trying to, oh, no, no, we're not talking about privatizing. We want you to have personal accounts for the Wall Street people to take over. Oh, that's not privatization. No, no. It's the same animal. It's the same thing Bush was touting. It's the same thing that conservatives have been going after since Social Security's inception. And I'm really hoping, and I'm pretty sure people are going to see through it and see what it is and hand Mr. Toomey his second defeat. Let's go to the phones. We got Jim on line two. How are we doing today, Jim?
Oh, Rick, I'm back. Listen, let me point out something to you. This business with Social Security and the privatization of that element, it started with the federal retirement system back in 83-84 under Reagan. And they transitioned from the civil service retirement system into what they call the federal employee retirement system, in which you would contribute into Social Security because federal employees did not.
Right.
And the reason for that, they said, was they needed to help out Social Security by making the federal worker contribute to it. And what they did was they destroyed the old civil service retirement system after 84, and they put it into FERS, which went into the stock market. And to supposedly under the pretext of bolstering Social Security. That was the model. That was step one. Step two is, now that they have Social Security in their sights, they're going to try and privatize that. And so what they did, they used the same model that was used under Reagan in a gradual transition to take the civil service retirement system. They wanted to put it under Social Security, which was a lie, and then they wanted to put the rest of it into the Federal Employee Retirement System and something called the Thrift Savings Program,
right,
headquartered in New Orleans. Well, you can imagine how that would be, and they had three funds under that, which have suffered greatly. And this is a gradual thing. This has been going on an awfully long time. And they took the model of 83-84, and they're trying to move it into a second stage. And now that they have Social Security in their sight, they're going to try to privatize that. And I want to ask you one thing.
Go ahead.
Their whole economic model was called the supply side, Laffer economics.
Yep.
And I want to ask you, how much has trickled down from people like Rush Limbaugh and some of these other people who are making $25 million a year? And, you know, they said, of course, the trickle-down economics would work and people would receive money and it would come through the economy through the trickle-down system. It hasn't worked.
Well, if you're
Bush
a...
one called it.
But if you're an... if you're
voodoo
a,
economics.
That's what Bush called it, yeah, absolutely. But if you're a housekeeper who knows where a good OxyContin dealer is, it does trickle down.
Well, you're referring to Mr. Limbaugh's problems with his back?
Sure, it's a little drug problem, sure.
Well, these people are, number one, drugged out. Number two, they are purposely malicious in their efforts to take money from people in their retirement accounts and move that money from your retirement account, which is supposed to sustain you in your old age, into their own dividend checks in their own coffers. Under the pretext, and it was expressed quite accurately in that 1987 movie, Wall Street, greed is good.
Yep.
And avarice is acceptable. So that's where this started from. Look it up.
Yeah, absolutely. No,
first, and you can see what I'm trying to say.
No, it's stuff that we've been talking about for years on this program. Look, you know, when Reagan took office, you know, the millionaire class, they became billionaire class. They didn't care about working people. They cared about how do you fill the coffers of the Coors found people and the Mars people and the Mellon Scaifes. That's who they cared about.
Well, you know, Reagan said if you're not, this is back in 1980, if you're not making $100,000 a year, you're broke. And of course, his wife, along with her wonderful friends like Betsy Bloomingdale and all that, her, you know, and Reagan with his kitchen cabinet. And some of the people he put in office, like Wicks, who ran a string of second-rate nursing homes. I mean, Nancy Reagan was saying, you know, ketchup is a vegetable. I tell you, for a good read on that, read the biography done on Nancy Reagan by Kitty Kelly. Kitty Kelly doesn't shoot blanks. No one's ever sued her. And for one book that exposed the Reagan administration, that's another. And I'll say this, so I'm going to get off the phone here. When Reagan instituted supply-side economics, his own budget director, David Stockman, said, this is not going to work. And they practically fired Stockman. He was OMB director.
Yep.
And he went to write a book called The Power of Politics, which further exposed the fallacy of this type of voodoo economics. What it would eventually do to this country.
Yep. Good points, Jim. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. You know, again, it's more neoliberalism. It's that Reagan-Thatcher model. You know, hopefully we'll give all the money to the people at the top and maybe they'll drop a few crumbs down to the rest of us. Let's go back to the phones. We got Mike on line two. How are we doing today, Mike?
Oh, fine. Other than the rain. With what you were talking about there, I wanted to talk about the quadruplets, but first, on the trickle-down, you seem to be missing the D and the W from trickle-down, and it's only showing up as trickle-on.
Good point. I've often said I'm wet enough. Thank you very much.
Okay. And the other thing was that your previous caller mentioned David Stockman. Well, here a couple of months ago, Stockman was on PBS, and they were talking about the bankers. And what the bankers were doing was they were borrowing money from the Federal Reserve, and they would go out and take and borrow something like $1 trillion and then put it into Treasury bills and pick up 3.5% interest on that and then pay the money back to the Fed and pay themselves nice big bonuses out of it. And Stockman said that never in history had there been a easier money-making scheme that he had seen, you know, because that's what they're doing. Nobody calls this welfare.
And that's exactly what it is. Yeah, exactly.
You know, but, you know, the twisted twins of Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin, Michelle elected and serving and Sarah elected and quit,
yep,
have now with the primaries out there in Nevada and Delaware become the quadruplets, you know, with Sharon Ingle and Christine O'Donnell joining them. And Ingle, in the past, apparently opposed a football team wearing black because black is evil, but apparently didn't understand two terms that should have brought that to question to her, and those two terms are, one, the Blues Brothers, and two, the Penguin, if you remember that.
Yep.
Now, because the Penguin happens to be the nun, and what color do nuns wear?
Oh, I know.
Sharon Ingle wants to go to the Senate so she can go to the Vatican and lecture the Pope about letting nuns wear the color of evil.
Well, no, hold on. Wait a second. I think I'm going to... write this down. I'm going to agree with Engel. Every nun that I had was evil.
Well, okay. I can understand that, and I mean, the writers of the movie had that in mind.
I still remember the beatings that I used to get all the time. Those were evil women. Evil women.
Well, they, unlike George Carlin, didn't come up with, as Carlin put it out, I used to be Irish Catholic, now I'm an American, you know, you grow.
Yep.
They apparently didn't grow.
Nope, and I blame it all on that whole, if you want to move that back to Christine O'Donnell, maybe if they were doing what Christine's against, maybe they'd have lightened up a bit.
But, well, O'Donnell on the masturbation as being adultery because according to the Bible, you have lusted in your heart, you have committed adultery. But, and how can you masturbate without lusting? But if a man were to masturbate to a photo of Christine O'Donnell, the self-proclaimed virgin from Delaware, never having been married, how could it be equated with adultery when adultery requires sex and not of the type of Bill and Monica, but real sex between a man and a married woman?
Well, I've heard people tell me adultery is just, just me thinking about it. That's lust in my heart, and that is betraying the relationship. I've had a whole seminar on this from some of my really, really far-out religious friends who, you know, because I say I sin twice a day. There's a woman up the street, a beautiful blonde, you know, your Baywatch kind of babe with a Jaguar. And I go, man, I'd really love to have that car and her with it. According to my teacher understanding, that's two sins for one thought.
True. It's kind of like Carlin's thing of wanna.
Yeah.
Wanna is the sin.
Just
wanna. Itself.
Exactly.
And but the thing is that adultery itself is defined in the Old Testament as sex between a man, be it a single man or a married man, and a woman who is married not to that man.
Correct.
And then it's changed in the New Testament by words of Jesus, which show up in Mark, Luke, and Matthew, and are ignored by most of the Protestants, because it says whosoever marrieth a divorced woman commits adultery, but we seem to have no concern over divorced women being remarried in Protestant churches that oppose the marriage of gays.
And if you're a Catholic, they still give annulments so you can pay the church off to forget about that first one or the second.
I think, what was it, one of the Kennedy family got an annulment when they had several children.
Yeah, good luck. I wonder how much that cost.
Yeah.
Good points.
But the thing is that what these women are saying makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, and I can't find it, but in the 2009 fall issues of the magazine The Nation, they had, I think it was a woman writer, talking about the 2008 Republican National Convention after Sarah Palin had been announced as the vice presidential candidate. And she said after that, all of a sudden you had all of these signs going up from the Republican delegates that read either MILF or GILF, which will not be explained for good reason.
Right.
And the thing is, how does Christine O'Donnell and Sharon Engel fit into a party of delegates who put up signs like that toward their married female vice presidential candidate?
That's a good question.
You know, and so it's like they've got all of these cross-cutting so-called values that aren't really values.
No values at all. And,
yeah.
And as I've said, the Huckabee thing, when Huckabee said, well, we shouldn't have pre-existing conditions, you know, because, you know, if I burn my house down, I shouldn't be able to buy insurance afterwards. You know, a good values sentiment. And you're right. They're all over the map.
Yeah,
which is which is really just shows the craziness of the movement.
With Huckabee, we've got to remember his Mike Dukakis moment of releasing a sexual predator who then went out and, I think, murdered and raped a woman in Missouri. And I think there may have been a second incident there that had shown up, because Huckabee had let this guy go because he had supposedly gone through this conversion to Christianity in prison.
Right. Yeah, jeez. It gets crazier and crazier every day. I got to take a break right
here. Okay, take Mike, care. Have a good day.
I appreciate the call. As always, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a quick break right here. We're right back after this. Stick around.
Right. The Rick Smith Show.
The surge is on in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, the surge that appears to be most effective is not the 30,000 additional U.S. troops that President Obama has now poured into this hellacious war, but a wholly unexpected surge by the enemy. General David Petraeus' surge strategy was to concentrate our soldiers in the Afghan south and east, attacking the Taliban where they are strongest. The gleaming gemstone of this plan was to be the taking of Kandahar, Afghanistan's second largest city and the birthplace of the Taliban. This goal was supposed to have been achieved months ago, but, well, stuff happens. Or in this case, doesn't happen. The assault on Kandahar is finally underway, but meanwhile the Taliban has slipped away and is surging throughout the country, including in provinces that were previously Taliban-free. Indeed, 4 years ago, the enemy had strongholds in only four of Afghanistan's 34 provinces. Now, they're in 33 of them, and practically every independent observer of the war says that Afghanistan has become more dangerous than at any time since our 2001 invasion. It's so dangerous that election officials simply shut down hundreds of polling places in 25 provinces for September's parliamentary elections. And international observers could not even go into the rural areas where most Afghans live. This gave a free hand to warlords and political power brokers to commit a massive level of voting fraud that delegitimizes the national election. Even America's hawkish foreign policy establishment has begun arguing that this war is neither winnable nor worth the enormous cost we're paying in lives, money, and reputation. As one establishmentarian now flatly says, a U.S. military victory over the Taliban is simply not necessary to protect U.S. interests. This is Jim Hightower saying, bingo!
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for?
Today in labor history, back in 1896, militia sent to Leadville, Colorado, to break the miners' strike there. The state sent in the militia to go after striking miners. Yeah, and that's part of our history. Also on this day, back in 1913, Mother Jones led the March of the Miners' Children through the streets of Charleston, West Virginia. And also on this day in 1982, the NFL Players Association began what became a 57-day strike, their first regular season walkout ever. And I remember that. I remember, you know, we actually practiced with the Browns. because, you know, I think I was in 10th grade then, and the Browns players needed somewhere just practice. Our head coach, one of the guys on the team, actually played at my high school, so he brought all of his buddies over to the high school, and we got to interact with the players, and it was an interesting experience. One I didn't really want because I wanted the players to get back to playing, but nonetheless.
I remember those days, and I think Buddy Ryan was the coach of the Eagles at the, and he hated, he loved his players, and he hated the replacement players. And I still remember that. I remember the unions down there, and your union was first and foremost. They protested. Thousands of them showed up at these. Well, they were scabs. I mean, let's be honest.
They were professional
football players, but they were still scabs, and they were taking away jobs from unionized workers. You call them whatever you want. I mean, professional football players are still workers because they have a contract. And thousands of them, and they raised holy you-know-what. Police came, and it was a mess, but it did keep a lot of fans out of the stadium. But I still remember Buddy Ryan. And to this day, the players love Buddy Ryan because he was loyal to his players, and he hated the scabs. Absolutely hated them.
Yeah, and then he went on to make a movie about scabs with, what's his name, Keanu Reeves and Gene Hackman.
Gene Hackman.
Yeah, they went and made a scab movie about the NFL, and I didn't like it, to be honest.
I don't know if you heard it today, Rick, but it came to light. Believe it or not, 48 hours, 2 days before health care reform is going to kick in. According to MSNBC, 4 health care providers have announced that they will discontinue covering children.
Actually, it's Anthem Blue Cross and Associate WellPoint, Aetna Incorporated, Cigna Incorporated, and Century One.
There you go.
And others have been under the radar making announcements that they will end child health offerings in the coming days.
And the reason is obvious.
Because of the health care.
2011, the law says that health care companies cannot deny coverage to a child because of pre-existing conditions.
So what we do then is we do what New York and Maine have done. If you want to sell insurance in the state of New York or Maine, you have to offer insurance to children. That's what we do. That's the response. If you want to offer, you want to sell your insurance in Pennsylvania, you have to abide by this.
And we're back to piecemealing it, unfortunately. I mean, we talk about some numbers, and we all know the numbers, although some of the numbers have been updated. The latest estimate is 52 million Americans without health care. Here's some numbers you might not have known, and they absolutely staggered me. Health insurance premiums for family coverage at a small business has increased 85% since 2000. 17% of our economic output is tied up in the healthcare system. We knew that. But here's two figures that just staggered me, Rick. Without reform, by 2040, one-third of our economic output would be tied up in healthcare. One-third. 15% of GDP. Now, remember, right now, 17% of GDP is tied up in all of healthcare. If there would be no reform by 2040, 15% of the GDP would be devoted simply to Medicare and Medicaid. Without reform, the number of uninsured would grow to 58 million by the year 2020, and I would submit to you at the rate that it's growing now, it could very well be more than 58 million.
Well, that's why we've got to kill off your generation.
Is that one way to do it?
You're too expensive. See, I'm actually thinking about changing over to the Republican Party and saying, you know, I'm agreeing. Just, you know, do away with this health care bill. Let them old people die.
Well, I mean, we're joking about it, but you know what? One of the problems with the Democrats and Obama, they got this passed, and we all know that it's not perfect. We all know that there's a lot of people in this country, including probably everyone in this room, that would have liked Medicare for all. But the truth is, this health care reform will do a lot of good.
Look,
but they haven't seen it yet. They haven't seen it.
And that's another problem with what they've done, and that's what they let the Republicans get away with and the conservative Democrats get away with, stretching this out. Oh, we need time for it to, you know, for it to, mm-hmm. to ease
What's
in.
The rush?
And I'm telling you, you know, mm-hmm. we're going to end up fighting these battles every step of the way now. the worst thing that can happen is that the Republicans take control of the House and Senate and starve.
They defund it, try to defund it.
They starve this bill. And as we've already established, they can do that. They have the ability to, you know, close the purse. They don't have to repeal the bill, just starve it. Just defund it. And if there's no money for it, how can it happen?
Well, you know, when these numbers came out, and they came out recently, and wow, it surprised me. In Pennsylvania, I believe the numbers were 54% of the people in Pennsylvania oppose health care reform. Yet you look around and you realize that Pennsylvania has the second oldest numbers of retirees, which means Medicare, which means all the things that the health care reform would do. Medicare was one of the good things. Reform, they took the excess cost out of it. When a lot of people, when they don't see it right in front of them, or they don't know a family member, or they don't know anyone who has been helped by health care reform, it's hard to tell them, well, you know, in 4 years, look at all that we're going to do for you. That's difficult. And therein lies the problem. But I believe Bill Clinton has it right. And I haven't seen the Democrats do it. And this is another area where the Republicans have just kicked the crap out of the Democrats. What the Democrats need to do, they need to say, look, this is what we've done. This is what we've done in the first 2 years. This is what we plan to do. This is what the Republicans will do to you if you elect them. You have to paint this mental picture. It has to be accurate, and you have to be successful. The Democrats have not done that. I don't see it. All their, you know, and Bill Clinton said another thing. If you allow the Republicans to say, you people mad, you have a right to be mad, now get out and vote, again, we lose, labor loses, the Democrats lose. We can't allow that to happen. We got about 5-6 weeks. We have to change this.
Yeah, and going back to your statement that 54% of the people in the state oppose this health care bill, you know, you look at the fact that, as you pointed out accurately, this is the second largest, the state has the second largest population of seniors living here. What the right has done very well, what the conservative movement has done very well, is scare the hell out of granny.
Absolutely.
If you remember, the old people were out in the streets and scared to death. I talked to my grandmother, who is not politically active at all. I honestly don't believe she's voted once in her life. But she is scared that they're going to take my Medicare away. And she would call me. I heard this. Is that true? And I'd say, no, Granny, that's not true. That's just, you know, that's just hyperbole.
Well, I tell you where
they did a good job of scaring.
They were successful, and I can go back, and I can remember at the union picnic, retirees that were, they were probably retired, probably 15 years, they were probably early to mid-70s. You know, and they're saying to me, when we start talking about health care, we start talking about, you know, supporting certain candidates, well, we don't want health care reform. It's going to hurt Medicare. It's going to hurt Medicare. And the Republicans have told them, look, under health care reform, they're going to take money out of Medicare, with the inference, incorrectly, that they're going to take the quality of health care and they're going to take things out of Medicare now that you enjoy. There was no such thing. What they did, they took the excess profits out of Medicare.
And I've said this before. If the Republicans want to repeal this health care bill, I will be the first one to stand in line to repeal Medicare then. Might as well scrap everything. We might as well go back to the days of suffering. We'll have a whole generation, your generation, die off in the street very visibly for people to see, and then we'll understand why we passed Medicare in the first place and why we need to have reform for the rest of us. Because in the current pay-or-die system, your generation is uninsurable. Uninsurable. With all the pre-existing conditions and all the ailments that come along with old age. If you stop and you think of what we've done in this country, we've taken all the risk out of it, out of health insurance. All of it. It's, you know, the only people that the government insures,
you're right,
the people who use health care, children and seniors.
And the private carriers have cherry-picked it.
And that's the problem. So now we got to go back and say, look, okay, well, you don't want this bill? Fine. You're going to have to insure everyone. But we're going to put a cap on what you can charge. So now you're going to have to pay for it one way or another. So if you're in love with the for-profit system, that's the way to go, man. But, you know, at the end of this, it comes down to people getting involved. It comes down to stop with the teabaggers are so energized and they're gonna steamroll. They're not. They're a small fringe element. We need to get sane, rational people to the polls. You need to talk to your friends and neighbors and say, you know what, as bad as the news is making it, it's not that bad. As bad as Fox News is telling you things are, oh my God, the sky is falling. It's not that bad. Remember, they've been saying Social Security is going to fail next year, every year for 75 years. It's the end of the world. The sky is falling. It's not. And you got to remember that. It didn't take us overnight to get into this mess. It's not going to be fixed overnight. We need to stay on a rational course. It's that simple. We can't go back. We just cannot go back. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming.